Good afternoon and welcome to Workforce and Business Development Finance and Policy Committee. I call this committee to order. Members and testifiers, please make sure that your mics are muted. This remote hearing is being conducted pursuant to Rule 10.01. This remote hearing can be viewed on the House webcast. With that, I ask the committee legislative assistant, Mr. Badri, to now take the role.
Chair Noor.
Present.
Chair Noor, present. Vice Chair Zhang.
Present.
Vice Chair Zhang, present. Hamilton.
Hamilton, present.
Lead Hamilton, present. Baker. Baker. Daphne.
Daphne, present.
Daphne, present. Frankie.
Frankie, present.
Frankie, present. Greenman.
Greenman, present.
Greenman, present. Haley. Haley. Jurgens.
Jurgens, present.
Jurgens, present. Cagle.
Cagle, present.
Cagle, present. Katiza Watun.
Present.
Katiza Watun, present. Olson.
Present.
Olson, present. Zhang.
Present.
Zhang, present. Baker. Baker. Haley. Haley. Chair Noor, we have a quorum.
Members, there's a quorum present. With that, I'll entertain a motion. Chair Daphne, will you move the minutes for March 28 for approval?
Mr. Chair, I do move. I so move. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Daphne. Chair Daphne moves the approval of minutes for March 28, 2022. Any discussion, members, or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. The motion is approved. The minutes for March 28, 2022 is now adopted. With that, members, today we have several bills, and if you are kind enough, we would like to go through most of those bills. And if we are unable to finish, there's an opportunity for us to do so in the evening. And also for a roadmap, we intend this to be our last big hearing for bills, and we'll be moving to the omnibus bill next week on Monday. So I'll be in touch with some of the members to explain how we will proceed with that. And we'll get started. House File 4565. Chair Becca Finn, welcome to the committee. This is a capital investment bill, and we will be hearing for information only and sending the recommendation to the Capital Investment Committee. Please welcome to the committee and tell us about your bill.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, everyone. I'm glad we could talk about this bill today. Really simply, this bill would fund a wellness center in the city of Cass Lake for the benefit of folks, everyone in the Leech Lake area. And I think most of you are probably aware of this, but I am Leech Lake Ojibwe myself. This is the community that I grew up in. This is my home community, and it's something that our community has never really had, and that's a health and wellness center for people of all ages. A couple things I wanted to touch on. You know, we've talked a lot in many committees about the missing and murdered Indigenous relatives issue, but another really tragic situation that we deal with in Native communities are rates of suicide. And I think this bill really can help us move in a good direction where we're taking care of people of all ages, and would really be a great asset to our community. Finally, we'll be hearing from a couple other folks, and I want to give them most of the time. I think we're all Cass Lake Bina High School graduates who grew up in the area, and I think many of you may not remember, but in 2004, the Star Tribune ran a series called The Lost Youth of Leech Lake, and it got a lot of things wrong about our community. But I think what's important now is that for myself and the other folks you're going to hear from today, we're now adults and we're now leading in our community. And this is a really positive thing that we're bringing forward for everybody in the region. And so I think it's really a reflection of how we build generation upon generation to improve things for our communities. So with that, I will turn it over to my testifiers so you can hear straight from the people of Cass Lake and the Leech Lake area. Thank you.
With that, we start with Chair Jackson Sr. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
This is Leroy Staples Fairbanks, the District 3 representative for Leech Lake. I don't believe Chairman Jackson will be on the call today.
Please proceed.
Thank you. I would like to thank the committee for their time and consideration of House File 4565, the Leech Lake Area Health and Wellness Center. And so just briefly, you know, as a council person for the Leech Lake government, you know, we consult with our community members on things that are affecting us, and health and wellness covers so many different areas of development and progressiveness of our community members, of their families. And this is a project that we've been planning for well over 10 years. And obviously, you know, it's if we want to do it right, it's going to take a lot of investment into doing it right. And so we did a lot of the preliminary work over the course of these last 10 years on talking with community members, working with outside agencies, school district, city of Cass Lake. I mean, everybody locally is pretty aware of our intentions of what we're trying to accomplish here. And there's been a little bit of chatter in a local town, Bemidji, Minnesota, which is a little over, you know, 15 miles away from Cass Lake, that they're talking about a wellness center in Bemidji. And so there's a lot of opportunity in Bemidji. They have the university, and the university has a lot of they have a fitness center and a wellness center there with pools and tracks and hoops and everything. And so, you know, what wellness looks like to Leech Lake, we have incorporated in our planning for this project. And it's something that's really important. And the future of Leech Lake, the longevity of our community members, the health of our community members, it relies on their ability to be well, to take care of themselves. And, you know, a project like this is something that was important to our community members, and it was a priority for us to be able to push forward. And I certainly appreciate the time and consideration of everybody on this call and this committee, and to kind of hear our presentation. And so I have a local Indian Council chairperson, Levi Brown, is here to share some information. So I'll pass it over to him.
Welcome, Chair Levi Brown. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chairman, our chair and committee. My name is Levi Brown. I'm the Noopamming Local Indian Council Chairman of the Noopamming community. And I just appreciate the time and thankful for all you today. I'm here to share information around important issues affecting our community in northern Minnesota. What we're planning to do to address these concerns, we plan on building an incubator of hope, something that everybody in our community can gather around and be proud of. And we plan on building this incubator of hope up on the Leech Lake Indian Reservation within the city of Cass Lake, on the shores of Cass Lake, Minnesota, which is the seventh largest lake in Minnesota. And our hope is that this center, you know, is going to be focused on physical and spiritual wellness, and that positive reinforcement of how the future can be what we make of it, not what has been done to us in the past. And that's what our community is really looking at doing, is moving forward. And so for the last 140 years, we've had so much happen to us up here in our community, whether it's land loss, over-harvesting of pristine timbers, non-tribal versus tribal misunderstandings in our community, the boarding schools that have destroyed our social and family structures that we have here today. All these dramatic events have led to these negative social issues in our community, like high number of incarceration, high numbers of drug use and alcohol use amongst our members. And I'm most sadly, and Representative Jamie Becker Finn mentioned this, you know, we're graduates of our high school, but a lot of the kids, people we grew up with, are incarcerated. They're not here today. And that comes from the drug use, the high level of drug use. And so that low graduation, high school graduation rate, mixed in with even a lower college graduation rate, these all are reflected, these social impacts monetarily are reflected in the packet and the information you've all been given. And I really hope you take the time to take a look at how such a small investment, even with a conservative projection, can be so big in a community. And I think that's where government does the most good, is where we invest in the areas that need investing and watch that blossom into, you know, something wonderful. And again, our community is proud, and we're focused on healing together, because we have non-tribal members living in our community as well. And I think the non-tribal community and the tribal community are, we have built coalitions together up here to make sure that everybody is prideful of our community. We know our history, but we own our future together. And we're always talking about that when we talk about this wellness center where a mother can be teaching her daughter about the importance of human health or the body and health. And while at the same time, you're looking at maybe two young brothers writing music together in our music room while elders are sitting there drinking coffee who are just got their diabetes clinic work. That intergenerational connection is what we're trying to share with you all today. And so in closing, I just wanted to offer this to the committee is that we put together a coalition of programs, partners, that include the city of Cass Lake, counties, school districts, and most importantly, our people. You know, I think that's why I'm honored to be able to talk here today. And I guess what my final ask is that, you know, you all make this, you know, help make this investment, this generational investment in change that, you know, when we look back 4 years old and I think of myself being an old guy sitting on a rocking chair, that we sat here at this moment and we took action. And so with that, Chair, I'll return it back and Miigwech for letting me share a little bit of our story.
Thank you so much, Chair Levi Brown. As you stated clearly, this is a small investment to address a significant disinvestment, historical one. So thank you so much for your testimony. With that, is there anyone else who wanted to testify on this bill? Seeing none, Chair Becca Finn, please, your closing remarks. Or members, do you have any questions? I see Representative Juggins.
Two quick questions. I'll ask them both at the same time for Representative Becker Finn. This is a request for cash appropriation. First question, is there also a request for general obligation bonds for this same project? The second question, is there a local match involved?
Chair Becker Finn.
So as to the cash VGO bonds, there are special circumstances when we're dealing with a tribal government that make it a little bit more complicated. So that's why there's the cash ask. I will turn it over to my testifiers as to the question on the match. But I can say that the tribe has put time and effort into researching this and looking into the need. So I know that there have been resources spent there, but I don't know if Leroy Fairbanks may have an answer as to match on funds moving forward.
Leroy Fairbanks, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to answer Representative Jurgensen's comment to our question. Yes, the plan is, and this does with our has to do with our partners and coalitions we're building. You know, we would house the Boys and Girls Club, county programs. The tribe basically would be we would be responsible for maintenance, upkeep, capital improvements, everything along that road. It would all be based on, it would basically, you're investing in us as a community for us to make this go and to do this and do it in a way that would make you all proud statewide. Miigwech.
Representative Juggins.
Thank you.
Chair Becca Finn, for your closing remarks.
Yeah, I just thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, everyone, for listening. For folks who have not been able to visit the Leech Lake area, let us know. We would love to host you. I know Chair Dabney has been ricing up in the Leech Lake area, but we would love to have more of you come visit our my beautiful home community. And just really appreciate, you know, your comments, Chair Noor. When my dad grew up, there wasn't even a public place where our young people were even allowed to swim because all of the lakeshore was not owned by our people anymore. And so it was difficult for them to even get access to those things. So the idea and the vision to build something like this for generations moving forward on the shores of our water is just really an incredible opportunity, I think, for everybody in our state to invest in something that's that level of importance. So Chi Miigwech to everybody for hearing us out. And thank you to my testifiers. We are a small but mighty group of folks from the Cass Lake, Leech Lake area.
Thank you so much, Chair Becker Finn, for bringing this forward, and also to the testifier, thank you for being here. To your next bill, Chair Becker Finn, House File, as I bring it up. 4024, I move to refer this file to Ways and Means Committee. To your bill, Chair Beckerfin.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Noor. And I will be brief because I'm going to try to keep you on schedule. I am also a chair with lots of bills in my committee. So this is a bill that would fund some programming through Give Minnesota. If you're familiar, probably most of you are familiar with Give to the Max Day, hopefully. Give MN is the group that's behind that. But what you might not know is that Give MN also provides other supports and programs for our nonprofits to help all of them be as successful as possible. Before I turn it over to my testifiers, I'll just ask you to take a look at the letter. It lists the number of organizations who are supportive of this bill, and it took us three pages to make sure everybody was listed. And so a lot of support in every area of the state for this effort. And with that, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you so much, Chair Beckerfin, for that brief introduction of the bill. To testify, Jack Bloomberg, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thanks so much, Chair Noor, and to the committee, thank you so much. For the record, my name is Jake Blumberg, and I am the executive director of GiveMN. GiveMN ignites generosity and grows giving across the state of Minnesota through our programs like GiveMN.org, Give to the Max Day, and RaiseMN. I'd like to thank Representative Beckerfin for authoring this bill, which will allow GiveMN to enable 1,000 nonprofits across Minnesota to become more self-sufficient and sustainable, while in turn positively impacting the Minnesota economy and employment markets. GiveMN is a 501c3 nonprofit organization founded in 2009. We're a nonpartisan, non-political organization that serves every 501c3 organization and public school across Minnesota. Regardless of their mission, we support their efforts to make our community stronger. Through millions of contributions, more than 14,000 organizations have raised nearly $500 million through our program since our inception. As the committee may already be aware, Minnesota's nonprofit sector makes up 14% of the state's workforce. The vitality of the nonprofit sector in Minnesota is not only critical to our economy, but is also a core resource that cares for our neighbors and our communities who need support. The committee may not be as aware of the makeup of the organizations in Minnesota's nonprofit sector. Nearly three quarters of Minnesota nonprofits have budgets of less than $1 million. And according to survey research, nearly half of Minnesota nonprofits rely solely on volunteers to fundraise to meet their missions. Critically, 69% of those Minnesota nonprofits are not confident they have the right fundraising strategy and capacity to meet their missions. In response to this landscape, we launched a program in 2017 to support the abilities of organizations, especially small volunteer-led organizations, to raise more money from individual donors specifically. RaiseMN is a coaching program to empower nonprofits to improve their own fundraising capacity. Rather than a consultant who does the work for an organization, we teach the organization's leaders how to fundraise sustainably for themselves. To liken it to a model that we may be more familiar with, working with RaiseMN is a lot like hiring a personal trainer to help get in shape and follow a healthy diet. Unlike Give to the Max Day, RaiseMN has an extensive application process which provides us with oversight to ensure the organizations we work with will use this support appropriately, responsibly, as they build toward their own financial sustainability. Like all of GiveMN's work, this application process remains non-political. Since RaiseMN's launch, we have worked with more than 500 organizations, primarily smaller organizations, many located in greater Minnesota, many led by and for BIPOC communities, which are historically under-resourced compared to white-led nonprofits. In the past year, 100% of the organizations we worked with reported increased fundraising confidence and knowledge from working with us, leading to significant gains in their fundraising outcomes. The support we offer organizations allows them to adapt to their landscapes and makes them much less reliant on institutions like foundations and the government, focusing their strategies instead toward the biggest renewable resource they have, individual donors. The organizations that we coach are now able to rely on donors in their communities rather than coming to the legislature every 2 years asking for funding to sustain them. In many cases, it will also allow organizations to add employees to their organizations, adding jobs to our economy as well. There are numerous examples of how this has positively played out for our organizational partners, and we're going to hear one of them shortly from Executive Director Kathy Mays. But one I will highlight myself is the Duluth Children's Museum. In late 2020, due to the pandemic, they encountered a nearly six-figure funding crisis that meant they would have had to shut their doors within 60 days if they did not address it. They relied on the training they had received in our program and raised over 180 $50,000 from their community. A volunteer from their board of directors told us this. The only thing that kept me from having a heart attack and curling up under my desk in a ball as this was all happening was the fundraising training we did with Raise MF. I was confident in making my asks and felt sure in my abilities to fundraise. We respectfully come to this committee with a one-time appropriation request, which will help us work with 1,000 organizations across the state and overcome the financial barrier those small but mighty organizations have in accessing resources like ours. This one-time appropriation, which will be matched by $1 million in non-state funds, will help those small organizations become more independent and sustainable and less reliant on institutional and government funding. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for your time and consideration. I'm looking forward to hearing from my colleague, Kathy Mays, about the story that she has to share, and I'm happy to stand for any questions. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Kathy Mays, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Oh, thank you, Chair Noor and members. For the record, my name is Kathy Mays. I'm the Executive Director of Loaves and Fishes, Minnesota. Thank you as well to Representative Becker Finn for offering this bill, which allows Give MN to help more nonprofits across Minnesota, just like they helped ours. Loaves and Fishes, obviously a nonprofit since 1982, we serve free healthy meals to those in need across Minnesota. We provide thousands of meals every single day and consider ourselves the largest free restaurant in Minnesota. We have seen a steady increase in meal needs since 2013. We hit the 1 million mark of meals in 2018. And in 2020, we quadrupled the amount of meals we served to 4.4 million meals. And this pace continues. Fortunately, in 2018, we began a year-long fundraising coaching program. And yes, it is much like having a personal trainer who is sometimes yelling at you with Raise MN. At the time, I was truly focused on just the opt side of the fence. I knew we had donors, we had lots of donors, but quite frankly, I knew their address. I might know a phone number and maybe an email and maybe his or her spouse's name. Because of the incredible coaching, we doubled the amount of donors and doubled the amount of giving from $500,000 to $1 million. It was because of that coaching, the time that I spent getting to know the donors, that when March 2020 hit, they actually started picking up the phone and calling me. It was because of relationships, and it was because of the hard work and because of the coaching. They said, Kathy, how can I help? Kathy, there's some stock coming. Be watching for it. Not only did it help us keep up with the pace, it helped me keep the faith that our team could do this hard work. In closing, I urge that you support GiveMN's proposal so that other executive directors can build donor confidence that will give way to their own success. Thank you, Chair and members, and I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Members discussion, I see Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Chair Becker Finn, for your bill. I actually know quite a bit about this organization. For Jake, who's on the Zoom here, I worked with this organization back when they first started and we launched it in Red Wing. You might know Dana Nelson when she was the original executive director, a very dynamic, vibrant woman. So, and at that time, I was doing nonprofit consulting work. So doing the training that you're talking about. So I understand what you're doing, and I'm a supporter of these nonprofits. I just know that there's a lot of groups that do this type of training, so I kind of struggle with how we, as a government, fund one. The St. Paul Foundation, the Minneapolis Foundation, Wilder Foundation, Nonprofits Assistance Fund, the United Way does a lot of capacity building training. As I said, I had a nonprofit consulting firm myself doing capacity building training. So that's my my struggle with the proposal today. Not that I don't support what you're doing, but I don't know how we single out with government money for this kind of training when there's a lot of groups that do it. My question for you, Mr. Bloomberg, is what is your total budget today? And do you still get the funds. Back when I worked with you, your operational funds were coming from some of those large institutions like the St. Paul Foundation, et cetera. And some of the major corporations in the state as well provided the startup funds when GiveMin was launched. So can you give me an idea of how your operational funding is structured today?
Mr. Bloomberg.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Thanks, Representative Haley. I'm happy to address the multiple points that you brought up, and thank you very much for that and also the historical context that you offered. So first and foremost, the list of organizations that you named that are in the capacity building space are all active partners of ours, and we are in active work with them in trying to serve the thousands of Minnesota nonprofits across our state. When Raise MN was created in 2017, we spent 2 years before it, in 2015, researching with those partners, as well as the community, what model might fit an existing gap in services. So when the St. Paul Foundation gave us our initial pilot funding for Raise MN, it was to meet this need for small nonprofits who are really trying to get their start, that are often BIPOC-led and serving or in greater Minnesota, that quite frankly don't make business sense for for-profit consultants to work with. They can't afford the rate and the margins. But if we spun up a social enterprise that would certainly be somewhat self-reliant and self-sustaining, because there are some clients that will graduate and then pay us for their ongoing services. But if we had philanthropy underwrite it, it brought the cost down and made it accessible for these nonprofit organizations. What's also different is we're not actually doing the work that a consultant might do for the nonprofit, but instead coaching them how to do it themselves to make them more reliant and able to self-sustain after we're gone, almost like construction scaffolding that helps a project get built up that is then strong enough when you remove it to go away. In terms of our current funding model, Representative, we continue to have support from major institutions like the St. Paul, Minnesota Foundations, the Bush Foundation. About 60% of our funding comes from philanthropy, individual and institutional. About 40%, however, comes from our social enterprise programs. GiveMN.org has a fee, transaction fee that part of goes to our general operating, and Raise MN, as it gets going and scales, also has enterprise money where folks are paying us to work with them. And that split will continue. What we're looking for here with this one-time appropriation is the ability to scale and get past that financial barrier for these organizations. And if our return rate of success of about 10 to 15% of organizations who come back to us for more were to continue, that will continue to keep the flywheel going after this one-time appropriation. In terms of the size of our general operating budget, right now we had a $1.8 million general operating budget for this current fiscal year. And that was to support both parts of our social enterprise, GiveMN.org, and its associated programs, as well as RaiseMN. I'm happy to further clarify, Mr. Chair or Representative Haley, if I can better answer your questions.
I'll encourage you to connect with Representative Haley so that you can discuss further on those issues. Representative Haley, as we have many bills to go through.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Bloomberg, for the information. I know we need to move on. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to ask some questions.
Thank you so much. Vice Chair Zhong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll keep this very brief. I just want to share that I co-founded a nonprofit organization, and we were able to use GiveMN a couple years ago, and it was very helpful to my small organization. My question to Mr. Bloomberg is, you mentioned that you are working with lots of BIPOC organizations, and I'm curious if the letter that we receive is that a list of all the BIPOC organizations. If not, can you send me a full list of the institutions you're working with? I really appreciate it.
Mr. Bloomberg, I'm sure you'll be sharing that information.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I am happy to share that information. The list that you received was not that cross-section, but we're happy to follow up with that, Mr. Vice Chair. Thank you so much for your question.
Lead Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bloomberg, if this one-time funding does not keep the flywheel open, as you put it, will you be back asking for more funds?
Mr. Bloomberg.
Mr. Chair and Representative. If any of us could predict the future, I think we probably would have been in different spots right now. That is not our plan. This is truly a one-time appropriation. What we have done in our history since 2009 is take leveraged investments for pilot programs and then made them self-sustainable. GiveMN.org has become a social enterprise that does sustain itself along with the opportunities to expand it through philanthropy. Private philanthropy has really helped us in this regard and will continue to step up, as well as the social enterprise that we've built RaiseMN to so far. The modeling that we are doing based off of the 500 organizations that we've worked with, as we scale it to 1,000, we would not anticipate, nor would I predict, that we would be back to the legislature anytime soon. This is really scaled one-time investment that would allow us to work with 1,000 organizations at a time that many of them, coming out of the pandemic, are desperate for recovery, are desperate for support, and will be on their own two feet with our support. Thank you, Representative and Mr. Chair. Happy to stand for further questions.
Lead Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Just wanted to note that, you know, our state is in better shape because of the nonprofits and the work that GiveMN and others are doing. As I say, a land of 10,000 lakes with 10,000 mighty nonprofits. So thank you so much to the testifiers. Chair Becker-Finn, to your closing remarks.
Just thank you for hearing the bill. It's a good project, and I hope that members will support it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. With that, I renew my motion that House File 4024 be re-referred to Ways and Means Committee. With that, Mr. Bedu will take the roll.
Chair Noor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Zhang?
Aye.
Lead Hamilton?
No.
Baker?
No.
Dabney?
Dabney, aye.
Frankie?
Frankie, aye.
Greenman?
Aye.
Haley?
No.
Juergens?
Juergens, aye.
Cagle?
Aye.
Katiza Watun?
Aye.
Olsen?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
Chair Noor, there are 10 ayes and 3 nays.
With 10 ayes and 3 nays, the motion is approved. And Chair Becker-Finn, you're on your way to Ways and Means. Thank you so much. And to the next bill, Chair Moran, welcome back to the committee. This is House File 4601. This is also a capital investment for informational hearing. Please tell us about your bill, Chair Moran.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I do think I have an amendment to the bill. Would you like for me to get it in order, or?
Yes, you have A1 amendment.
Yes.
If you can brief, I'll move A1 amendment. If you can tell us about the A1 amendment.
So the A1 amendment, the appropriation amount changes from 1 million to 8.2. The project phases of construct and furnish are added to the pre-design and design, which are in the bill as introduced. And it describes the project as a new building rather than a renovation. A technical change is added, clarifying that appropriation is a one-time appropriation and an effective date of day following final enactment is added.
Thank you, Chair Moran. With that, members, any discussion for the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Seeing none, the amendment is adapted to your bill as amended, Chair Moran.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 4601 is a bill for the YWCA St. Paul, who has served the city of St. Paul in Ramsey County since 1907. With a mission of eliminating racism and empowering women, the YWCA programs empower low-income women and families from communities of color through direct services in support of housing, youth development, and employment, all areas of deep racial disparities that we see in Minnesota. St. Paul's, the YWCA St. Paul serves the community through advocacy and racial justice education, and they operate a health and fitness center, which financially supports their programs while also supporting the health and the wellness in the broader community. To help more women realize their dreams, and to support a more just and equitable St. Paul, the YWCA is launching a historic redevelopment project. The YWCA seeks to construct a new building on its current site, which will replace its aging facility, remember it's been there since 1907, with a more flexible, accessible, and welcoming community space for people to participate in transformative programming and services. The new building will be specifically designed to support expanded programming and employment services, youth development and housing services, as well as community engagement. It will also house the administrative operations and their revenue-generating health and fitness center. The building is part of a larger redevelopment project that would transform their current property into a greater community asset. The project will create the opportunity for a nonprofit affordable housing developer to build affordable housing and possibly supportive housing on the site, which we know is critically needed in St. Paul. It's also a great opportunity for other partners to add minority-owned businesses in the site's footprint. So they are asking the state of Minnesota to fund $8.2 million of the $37 million project costs of the YWCA new facility. And with that, Mr. Chair, I know we have a testifier.
Thank you, Chair Moran. I see... Ms. Macy, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chairman Knorr, Vice Chair Zhang, Representative Moran, and members of the committee. My name is Gay Adams Massey, and I am the CEO of YWCA St. Paul. I thank you for hearing testimony on House File 4601, and I really appreciate the opportunity to share our project with you, and thank you for all you do to support our communities. YWCA St. Paul, as Representative Moran mentioned, has been serving the city of St. Paul and Ramsey County since 1907. Over the past three decades, we've operated from our headquarters on Selby Avenue. It's at the corner of Selby and Western, which is really at the meeting place of the old Rondo neighborhood and the Cathedral Hill neighborhood. We're a Black-led organization. We serve women and children as part of our mission to eliminate racism and empower women. As Representative Moran mentioned, our key service areas are around supportive housing. We provide transitional and permanent supportive housing for families in Ramsey County. We use development work, and we provide employment services in several areas that really help address some of the deep disparities in employment and housing and youth achievement in communities of color here in Minnesota. We also do education around racial justice issues in the state, and as you mentioned, we operate a health and fitness center just on our site. It's our social enterprise. It financially supports our programs while supporting the health and wellness in our broader community. So our project is a new facility for YWCA St. Paul. Facility would be on its existing site, which when transformed, would allow our aging facility to be replaced with a community asset and revenue-generating social enterprise. It would allow us to expand our programming, and we've had third-party analysis that has projected substantially increased revenue from the new facility, which we could reinvest in our programs, operation, and capacity, allowing us to serve more people in need of our support. We have entered into a partnership. We're entering into a partnership with Project for Pride and Living, PPL, who many of you may know. It's a nonprofit affordable housing developer to build affordable housing on the site, something that's really needed in the area. We're hopeful two of having some units of supportive housing for which YWCA St. Paul would provide support to the residents. We're also expect to partner with the Neighborhood Development Center to create asset building opportunities by adding minority-owned businesses to the site. So it's a really prime retail location there at SLB and Western. We're asking the state to fund $8.2 million of the $37 million project for the new facility. The remainder of the funds would come from a capital campaign, sale of land, financing, and other sources. We're really excited by the prospect of this new facility and the opportunity it would give us to expand our services in the community. We really want to bring additional benefit and serve more low-income women and families and communities of color who are seeking to escape homelessness and overcome barriers in education and employment. Families in the community would be able to access new affordable housing units, and aspiring minority small business owners will have access to this prime retail location. And we all know that entrepreneurs create wealth that impacts generations in the community. We will be able to generate greater earned income through our fitness center and social enterprise, which we can direct toward our programs and operations. You know, as you likely know, earned income is a particular benefit to nonprofit organizations. It lets us invest in our staff and our equipment, as well as our direct service work, and helps us to continue to deliver critically needed services when there are changes in the philanthropic priorities of our traditional donors and funders. So we know the redevelopment would significantly contribute to the vibrancy of Rondo and Cathedral Hill, allow us to bring more resources to the community, and we ask for your support of this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to share the project, and we appreciate your consideration. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Members, discussion? Seeing none, Chair Moran, your closing remarks.
Well, Mr. Chair, and members, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to bring this bill through your committee. I believe it's going on to capital investment. It's a good investment. It's a good project, and it's going to move us forward. So thank you for your time, and I ask for your support.
Thank you so much, Chair Moran, and to the testifier for your time and bringing this bill forward. Looking forward to sending the recommendations to the capital investment soon. So thank you.
Thank you.
The next bill is House File 4522. Vice Chair Sunstead, welcome to the committee. I move to lay House File 4522 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Please introduce your bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. We all know how hard the pandemic was on our small businesses, and I'm confident that there isn't a single member among us who didn't receive literally hundreds of calls, emails, et cetera, from bars, restaurants, gyms, movie theaters, and other establishments who were impacted by the pandemic. These are real people who faced real, unimaginable hardship due to no fault of their own. While I'm not looking to relitigate our state's public health approach as it related to businesses, I do think that we can all agree that they deserve some type of an assistance, a lifeline, to remain in operation. As major global conglomerates like Walmart, Target, and Amazon did much better than ever, our smallest businesses in Minnesota faced a squeeze unlike anything they've had to experience before. Many hung on by just a thread, while many more simply couldn't survive the impossible environment. So, on more than one occasion, both here in St. Paul and in D.C., we did the right thing and stepped up to help. While I'm proud that we were able to work together to deliver over $1 billion worth of aid to businesses since the onset of the pandemic, it's clear that there is still more to do. House File 4522 creates a pandemic relief grant program, investing $100 million worth of grants up to $25,000 each to businesses that employ 50 or fewer people. The bill will ensure grant recipients are roughly split between businesses in the metro and greater Minnesota. Eligible businesses include food and beverage, personal services, indoor entertainment, fitness and sports centers, and wellness and recreation centers. Grants would determine or would be determined through the lottery process. It seems the light at the end of the tunnel keeps moving further away the longer we go, but now I'm glad it appears we're starting to leave the pandemic behind us, hopefully once and for all. Even with this, the hardship isn't over yet. Now businesses are struggling with increased costs and tight labor markets. Despite their ability to be fully open without any COVID-related restrictions, it isn't an easy path forward for many of our smallest businesses that operate on very small margins. This bill is just one solution I'm hopeful this committee can explore this session as we look on a broader scale about how we can help our small businesses, the lifeblood of our Main Street economies. Once again, I hope that they can start to thrive. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would stand for any questions.
Thank you so much for bringing the bill forward. I do have two testifiers. Mr. Wolfson, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ben Wogsland. I'm the Executive Vice President with Hospitality Minnesota, representing Minnesota's restaurant and food service, hotel and lodging, and resort and campground industries. I want to start off by thanking the author, Representative Stanstead, for her leadership in bringing this forward, and to you, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill, members and staff as well for having this conversation. This is really important to our industry. We think there's a strong case for need in the economic recovery for this industry. Some of the operators in this industry obviously were shut down and limited, potentially up to 249 days of revenue that was lost over the last 2 years. In addition to other COVID conditions over the last year, we estimate that about $15 billion of revenue was lost during that period. And during that time, your small hospitality businesses, you know, their bills continued to come, right? Rent, lease, mortgage, utilities, taxes, you name it. So many of them have taken on significant debt. And I know I recently was able to share some statistics with you all about the workforce issue for our industry, but I want to provide a couple of statistics from our most recent survey with the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank and Explore Minnesota Tourism. 64% of food service operators indicated that their winter revenue was lower than normal, and over half of hotels. Over half of both food service and hotel operators indicate that they expect lower than normal revenue here in the spring revenue, and about half of restaurants and hotels are projecting that their revenue is not going to return to normal until 2023. And by normal, we're referring to pre-pandemic conditions. What does this all mean? Well, it means that half of food service operators are still telling us through the survey that they are in jeopardy of insolvency in the next 6 to 12 months, which is concerning for an industry that in normal times employs 1 in 10 Minnesotans here in our state. So with those reduced revenues and those projections, there are some concerns about, you know, having to take on additional costs at the same time. We know that there are supply chain issues from the survey, and we also know that 59% of operators indicated that their wholesale purchase prices have jumped 5 to 10% or even more over this last year. So those are the challenges and headwinds that are facing this industry. We feel from our position that the state is in a unique position given the federal dollars that have flowed to the state and the $9 billion plus surplus to provide direct recovery assistance to many of these small businesses that have been hardest hit by the pandemic and the conditions of the last 2 years. We think that this relief will help them to, you know, both with the speed and the depth of the economic recovery here in this year in an industry that, again, employs, you know, 1 in 10 Minnesotans during normal times. I'd just like to close by making two suggestions as the committee thinks about this issue broadly and as the session goes forward and we start to look at targets and what we can do. I know you all have a very tough job in balancing all the needs out there that Minnesota has right now, but we would ask you to consider or contemplate a grant program for overnight accommodations or hotels or motels. To date, there still has not been a program stood up at the state level here in Minnesota to help those folks, which were significantly harmed by the pandemic. And keep in mind, many of these are small independent owners and businesses as well. So we would ask for that consideration or conversation going forward. And then secondly, we would also ask for consideration for expanding the overall target of the grant relief program and the grant amounts. I really appreciate talking with Senator or Representative Sandstead recently about kind of what some other states have done. And, you know, I wanted to point out just as a model, for example, that Wisconsin to the east has to date issued $980 million in grant relief directly to small businesses. And I know here in Minnesota, we do almost everything better than our neighbors to the east. But I think that we feel strongly that Minnesota would benefit from taking a hard look at doing some larger targets for relief. And I think that will overall help our economic recovery here in Minnesota move along quicker, especially when it comes to, you know, an industry that employs so many of our fellow Minnesotans. So happy to provide more details or answer any questions, Mr. Chair. I just want to say appreciate you hearing this bill, appreciate the author and all of you for doing whatever you can to help this industry get back on its feet. Thank you.
Thank you. The next testifier is Ms. Hansen. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you very much. My name is Shelley Hansen. I am the president of the Hibbing Area Chamber of Commerce in Hibbing. And I am very appreciative to have the opportunity to speak to this committee and represent the 300 businesses in our area who are learning to conduct their businesses differently from the effects that COVID-19 has presented to them. And the previous presenter spoke about those different challenges that we've had. One of the things is payroll and staffing that we're seeing. Of course, I have one business who reports that he's paying $3,000 more a month in staffing, and that's for less staff. And so this initially results in the fact that he has to close his business one day a week in order to compensate that. I have another business who's reporting that they're paying double minimum wage for a position that they normally would have paid minimum wage or a few dollars more for incentives for longevity, experience, or good performance. They no longer can do that because they're paying double what they were paying prior to that. And that's just for competing for staff in order to get staff into working. One of the things that we're looking at, of course, too, is the supply chain issue and the supply chain costs. I have one hair salon in the community who normally would pay $7 for a box of supplies to do hair coloring. She now has to pay $20. Not only that, but she also has to change the way she does her business because people do not want to be double booked in the fact that she's working with one client and starting another client. So now because of cleaning costs, the cleaning costs have gone up. The way she does her business has changed. So now that she has longer hours that she has to work. We're also seeing a change in taxes, utilities, and insurances. They've all gone up. One business reports an increase by $2,000, and they did have to pay all their license fees, their taxes, their rents throughout COVID. Now they're seeing those increases on top of it as well. And so when our small town businesses struggle, our communities struggle as well. And so this grant program is not just for our businesses, it's for our communities and for our restaurants, for our residents in our communities. Because we know that our businesses, they pay taxes in our communities, they employ our people within our communities, they provide services for our communities, and they support our community organizations, such as anything from a cancer benefit to our baseball teams and our basketball teams. So by supporting our small businesses in this manner, by offering this grant to them during this time to get them into that 2023 projection, I think this would also be just a huge ripple effect for all of our communities to support them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen, for your testimony. I see Representative Frankie. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Sandstead. A few questions here. And my first question would be line 2.15, as far as the grant criteria, be able to demonstrate a financial hardship during 2022 as a result of the COVID-19 outbreak. Now, I'm wondering how you're going to be able to demonstrate that you're having a hardship now because of the COVID-19 outbreak when everybody seems to agree we're on the backside of this. I would gather to think it's more because of increased costs, supply chain issues, everything that everybody's saying, because I get it, I'm living it. But why 2022? I mean, right now I think that the burden is more on our taxation, the mandates we're putting on businesses, our inability to get unemployment passed. And so how and why are we not looking back, engaging it to the businesses that took the losses in 20 and 21 or weren't able to get some of the programs like the depleted restaurant revitalization program, some of the venues, our music and arts venues that were left out. And like Ben mentioned, the hotels and motels, and geared towards these businesses that weren't able to get some of these. Instead of looking towards the year we are currently in, where I would argue that the issues we're having now are not the issues we had then. They may be a result of what happened, but how are you going to prove that? And so then you are once again going to create a system where some are going to be able to have gotten just about every single program, and some are going to once again get zero. So why not gear this program towards those who haven't received any help yet?
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Representative Frankie. Actually, in your comment, I'm hearing two questions. I'm hearing you ask, like, what about industries or businesses that have been left out? I am just going to go on the record and say I don't think this has to be a comprehensive list, what you see in this bill currently. I am very open to exploring the options of some of those other industries or businesses that you mentioned were left out. So I'm happy to have that conversation. As far as 2022, I think you're right that a lot of the things that we're hearing about now impacting businesses may be a result of the pandemic, but they're not identical or they're not specific to the pandemic happening at this moment. I think it's still important that we recognize they're struggling, whether it's a result of the pandemic, whether it's now supply chain issues, whatever this is, we need to be doing something to help these businesses out. And I think that $25,000 grants is a great shot in the arm to give them the boost that they need. Not every issue is going to be the same among different employers, different businesses. So I'm not trying to be micromanaging what the cause is, but I think assisting them, recognizing that they need the help is what we need to do. And I think that they will be able to identify and, record, give the evidence of the fact that they're still not making it. They're still struggling financially. And I just think that this is a good bill to give them that boost, that shot in the arm, and get them up and going. That's the most important thing. I don't think trying to delineate the exact cause is really what we need to do. We need to get them back on their feet. We need to give them that shot in the arm to get them up and going again, to revitalize our communities.
Representative Frank.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Sandsteed. I guess I just don't understand how are we going to gauge the provability? There's no direction on how that's going to happen. Like, based off your, some of the programs that I've seen where, compare your 2019 to your 2020, 2020 to your 2021, this time to this time. There's just nothing in this bill that says that. And I think it be more than happy to take your help to get the UI passed. I think that'll help small businesses and get other things done to help sometimes I just get a little ahead of myself here because I'm living it every day. I mean, right now, I agree. And I've been talking with my colleagues, now it's small businesses in my industry, we have bird flu, costs are going up. A lot of it has nothing to do with COVID. So I think that, we need to really figure out how we're going to help those who are still in need versus those who will just, are having a hard time as a result of something else.
Thank you so much for your comment, Representative Frankie. Vice Chair Sandsteed.
Thanks. I just want to respond to Representative Frankie and say that in the application process or in the bill itself, it says that these forms will be created. It's my understanding that they will follow the same process of many of the other grants that the state has already put forth. And those criteria, those requirements will be spelled out in that application. So it's not just some loosey-goosey, throw some documentation out and it happens. So I'm pretty confident on the grants that we've already done. They've set a good model for the work that we're hopefully going to continue doing here. And I do want to say that it's important that we also take care of UI. However, this bill, I think, will do more for our small businesses than some of the, you know, GOP proposals that we've heard. In those proposals, we're looking at $2,200 to $2,300 relief per business. That's, in the scope of things, so minuscule, almost nothing, compared to a grant of up to $25,000. So I agree we have to take care of both, but I think this is probably a better approach.
Representative Frank, I'll move to Representative Juggins if you don't have any further questions. All right.
Well, I do, but that's fine, Mr. Chair. We'll move along. Representative Juggins. Thank you, Representative Sandstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question for Representative Sandstein is the source of funds. It says in the bill general fund, but is this American Rescue Plan dollars? Is it state recovery fiscal fund dollars? Is this part of the $1.15 billion that the legislature can direct before June 15th? Can you give me a better understanding of where this money's coming from, please?
Mr. Chair?
Vice Chair Sands.
It is my understanding that these are general fund dollars.
Representative
dollars.
So it's not part of the ARP money, the federal money that the state has. Second question then, it says eligible expenses, rent, mortgage payments, utility bills, payroll expenses. So would an eligible expense be the increase in payroll taxes that businesses are paying as a result of not resolving the UI trust fund issue? Would that be an eligible expense that these businesses could use this money for?
I know Vice Chair Sunstead talked about that issue, but if she said it's not related, but I'll let her respond to that too. Vice Chair,
thank you. That's a great question, Representative Juergens. I'm confident we're going to take care of both. So I don't want to get ahead of my skis on this one. I am confident that if we commit ourselves to working together, we can take care of both of these.
Just one quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Going back to my first question, why did we choose not to use ARP funds for this?
If I may respond, I think if you're looking at how we were spending that ARP funds, we passed in this committee to spend it on the UI Trust Fund, and we have already spent it all on that purpose, if you recall. So in terms of having a balanced budget process, we cannot reuse something that we've already used for the purpose of replenishing and paying the debt for the unemployment.
Okay.
Does that answer your question, Representative Juggins?
Well, it hasn't been used because it hasn't been signed by the governor yet, but we don't need to get into the details. I understand what you're saying. It was passed out of this committee and out of, I'll just let it go with that. Thank you.
Thank you so much. See no further discussion from members. Vice Chair Sunstead, for your closing remarks.
Thank you for hearing the bill, Mr. Chair and members. I hope that if you have suggestions, you understand that I'm open to hearing those, and I'd be happy to work together on this, and I would urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you so much for bringing the bill forward, and looking forward to having the conversation how we can support small businesses who have been impacted. So the next bill that I see on the calendar on the list is House File 4075. Representative Tujong, welcome to your committee. Please move the bill and introduce it.
Thank you, Chair and committee. Mr. Chair, members, I have a amendment that I would also like to be adopted to put the bill in the correct form, please.
All right. Our Representative Tujong moves the House File 4075 to be laid over for possible inclusion, and there is a DE1 author's amendment. He also moves the DE1 to the DE1. Members, this puts the bill in the shape the author really wants. Any discussion? See none. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? See none. To your bill as amended, Representative Tujong.
Thank you, Chair. This is a House File 4075 is a bill which will help Minnesotans with disabilities continue to have access to quality jobs job placement services and on the job support services through the extended employment or EE program. This program is housed in DEED's Vocational Rehabilitation Service Program. Because of the drastic increase in marketplace hourly wages, EE providers are struggling to maintain adequate staff levels. Therefore, House File 4075 increases the base general fund allocation for the EE provider rate by 2.285 million to starting in fiscal year 2024. Mr. Chair, I give you a more detailed, I could give you a more detailed explanation of the need of House File 4075. I have Liz Parte and a client from Functional Industries available to testify virtually.
Welcome, Ms. Parte. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Lisa Parte. Thank you, Representative Knorr, Chair Knorr, and committee for hearing this bill today in testimony. Unfortunately, Tyler had to leave. I apologize for the background noise, but we are at his job, and he was busy working. So extended employment is a pay for performance program, which provides individuals with disabilities services, which enable them to be successful in maintaining their jobs in the community around the state of Minnesota. As job openings have increased, more individuals with disabilities have gained employment in their communities. These extended employment services are critical for individuals as they provide the supports for both the individual and the employers to ensure success on the job. Increased funding is going to help with sustaining current caseloads and meeting underserved and unserved populations. It's also going to help to respond to current employee workforce shortages and general employer costs such as healthcare, workers' compensation, and increased hourly rates. It also addresses increased costs due to COVID, WIOA requirements, and extended employment rule changes. I cannot express how critical these funds are for the people we serve. If Tyler could have stayed, he would have told you that these services are what help him to maintain his employment in the community. Thank you so much for hearing this bill, and just know that without adequate EE funding, waiting lists could start up again, and certain categories of services could possibly close. Residents could become more isolated rather than more integrated into the community, and there could be increased state costs for additional services. So thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Did you say the client isn't available to testify?
He is not. He had to go back to work. Sorry.
Well, no problem. Thank you so much. Appreciate you testifying on the bill. Discussion members. Lynn Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Parte, first of all, I just want to say thank you for all that you do to help those who have disabilities. It's a passion of mine as well. So I want to thank you, and I'd also like to thank Representative Young for bringing this bill forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you so much, Lead Hamilton. To your closing remarks, Vice Chair Toujon. You're muted.
Sorry. The goal of this bill is to continue serving Minnesotans with disabilities in the workplace. And I think this is helpful for the drastic increase in marketplace hourly wages. And so, I appreciate your time and urge your support for this bill to be included in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Vice Chair Toujong. With that, Representative Toujong renews his motion to lay over House File 4075. As amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Members, the next bill is my bill, and this is an important bill for us to have the conversation, House File 4215, and I transfer the chairmanship to Vice Chair Jay Zhang.
All right, Vice Chair Nor, would you like to make a motion and introduce your bill?
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 4215 to be re-referred to Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Finance and Policy Committee. With that, members, I'd like to introduce the bill. This is House File 4215. It creates a stronger pathways from prison to employment, or what I will otherwise say, it's from jails to jobs, through investment at the Minnesota Department of Corrections. This bill makes investment where it directs connection from employment to public safety in a plainly clear way. Members, we understand the challenges that we're facing in our state. When individuals leave prison employed with skills, training, and education, we are all safer. They can support themselves, their families, and invest in their future. This bill invests a total of $3 million in fiscal year 2023 and $4.5 million each year thereafter to do three things. First, the bill increases the Department of Corrections' ability to contract with institutions of higher education, including vocational schools and community colleges. Second, it creates a public safety and economic opportunity unit at the Department of Correction to establish partnership with trade schools, unions, and public and private employers. The unit will help individuals connect with jobs and assist with navigation of employment. Finally, for those incarcerated individuals who qualify for work release, it allows them to continue with their ongoing full-time education. This is a game changer for those who really need help with the crisis as we're facing on workforce shortages. With that, I will ask for your support for this bill, and I have the Commissioner for Department of Corrections, Mr. Commissioner Schnell.
Mr. Schnell, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair and everyone. My name is Paul Schnell, I'm the Commissioner of Corrections. I want to thank Chair Noor for authoring this package that I think really meets two challenges that we all know Minnesota is facing. Issues around rising crime and concern about that, and workforce shortages. We must have a comprehensive approach to responding to crime and make sure that we're investing in what works to keep communities safe. Community safety is only possible when communities, the state, and all of us work together to create opportunities by holding people accountable, delivering justice, and really meeting the needs of Minnesotans generally. Representative Noor laid out the governor's budget request well for this package. This request is all about giving people opportunities to succeed. It is upon their return to the communities and has bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate. I believe that all of you have received an informational packet that includes a fact sheet along with letters of support from numerous organizations around the state. And I'll be happy to answer any questions as we go forward. As an important reminder, 95% of the people in Minnesota's prisons will return to communities across our state. And our safety depends upon their successful reintegration into our society. This package helps improve those chances by creating pathways from prison to employment or jail to jobs, as Chair Noor refers to it. People who engage in education programming and who are gainfully employed have far better chances of succeeding when they return back to their communities. Some have made the comment that there is no greater crime prevention mechanism for people returning back to their communities from incarceration than a good job. Today, the men and women serving in the DOC continue this commitment of transforming lives to create a safer Minnesota. They work hard to provide education programming and prepare those leaving our facilities for employment as much as possible. But oftentimes, resources are lacking. We know that if we want to address repeat offending and increase and reduce the issues around violent crime that we've heard so much about, we must recommit ourselves to the notion that our work doesn't end by simply holding people accountable, arresting them, locking them up, sending them to prison. That ultimately, it has to be about what happens while they are in our prisons and the levels of support that they have upon transition back to the community. In the DOC's recently released homelessness data report, we found that 25% of those released from our prisons are leaving homeless. Not just because they lack affordable housing or barriers to finding homes, but because they simply can't afford rent because they don't have jobs. When you realize that the unemployment rate for formerly incarcerated stands at about 27%, we know that there are dots that must be connected. Part of that work will come through funding this package to help develop and strengthen relationships in the community, bringing together both public and private sector employers, the trades, trade unions, community college, and post-associate's degree pathways. Employment navigation will further pave the return from prison to community in ways that will help stabilize and create long-term stability and jobs in our community. This proposal will also help those who only spend short periods of time within the Department of Corrections and are not able to engage in full-scale programming while they're inside, because there will be critical transition services and pathways as they return to the community. Several states have been doing this work, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, and even our neighbor to the east, Wisconsin. As you can see on this slide, Indiana's DOC's hire program has regional staff whose entire job it is to support those leaving prison find employment. These staff work with local employers to build strong private-public partnerships to create those pathways. Indiana's now decades-old program has partnerships with over 8,700 businesses from across their state, and they've aided thousands of people leaving prisons and entering Indiana's workforce in fields such as maintenance, construction, food services, and manufacturing, just to name a few. While our current staff do some of this work today, they simply do not have the resources or capacity to achieve the kinds of outcome Indiana sees each year. Chairman members, as legislators, I know you see better than I do what opportunities exist here. The communities you serve and represent and the businesses that exist within them are struggling with both the concerns for crime and severe workforce shortages. We know that people who have been incarcerated can, and research tells us often do, make incredibly loyal employees to employers when they know they have a decent job and employers who are willing to take a chance on them. And that's the big reason the DOC and our partners are hearing more and more these days from companies in our communities and from trade unions looking to create partnerships, ultimately to build these strong pathways to meet the needs. This comes from a solar power plant on the Iron Range to a glass manufacturer in Faribault, from metal producers in Ham Lake to aluminum smelting firm in Rosemont. Employers struggling to meet their employment needs are eager to partner, but we don't have the capacity to build the pathways to create and meet these needs. Last year, we met with several trade unions, electricians, carpenters, building and construction, boilermakers, and bricklayers, and all had the same request. Help us help the businesses our members serve meet the needs of Minnesota. This bill will greatly expand the capacity of the DOC to carry out this mission that we are held to, and that is investing in what works, investing in things that transform lives to create a safer Minnesota. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, I stand for any questions you may have. But again, I appreciate the time today to hear and consider this bill.
Thank you, Commissioner Schnell. Chair Noor, I believe you have one more testifier, Commissioner Moore.
Yes.
My name is. Identify yourself for the record and proceed, Commissioner.
My name is Marlon Moore. I'm a commissioner from the Minneapolis Civil Public Safety Committee Council, and we are in support of this of Rule 4, 1215. As we begin to build out these vehicles to pathways to the incarcerated come home, the funding allows them to really have a real conversation with those who are at the boots of the ground, who are doing the groundwork. Pairing these services, a lot of the employers are looking for additional mental health services for these people who are coming home as it pertains to being successful in returning back home, as well as housing that was mentioned before. It allows us to find the funding to be able to put people in appropriate housing as they try to restabilize themselves, because these are the supporting issues that come along with coming back home, not just the fact that you're returning, but that you have a solid foundation and a secure foundation in which you are able to operate from. By doing this, we are able to do that and build out things that are really with trusted and vetted agencies like Twin Cities Rise, Salem Inc., Emerge, who I worked with, Salem Inc., and we over the last three or four years working with the Center of Economic Inclusion have been with over 3,000 men, getting them to employment and seeing some of those barriers that exist to employers to keep people at work, including simple things as boots. And so when you're able to give them this kind of funding, you build this trusted network around them that makes them know that they have somebody they can rely on as they try to redevelop their lives. Housing is a major concern, because although they come at home, they might come home on straight parole or ISR or whatever it may have you, they're returning to a community that they no longer may be able to exist in. If you come home on ISR and you're going home to a home that's not in the direction you're going, you're bound to come back. So we're able to create these pathways and create these cohorts to help them to do just that. And so we are very much so in support of that as they begin to build out these vehicles and getting men and women return home in a capacity where they're now, as was said, they're very loyal and consistent in what they're trying to do when they have those supportive networks around them, because mental health plays a major role, housing plays a major role, reconnecting with your family and how to do that. And these employers need this kind of services to sustain good working, hard individuals. So we're in support and short of Rule 4, 12, 15.
Thank you, Commissioner Moore, for your testimony. Members, any questions? Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Noor. Thank you, Commissioner Schnell. Is this a new program?
Chair Noor?
That was a question to Commissioner Schnell.
Commissioner Schnell?
Commissioner.
Yes, to the commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Frankie. This we have a very small, limited transition team that does work on this today, reentry, but there we have not been able to meet the needs, for instance, of some of the employers who've come in. We have worked a little bit with DEED on some of these things, but they've been challenged as well. What we would look to do with this is create stronger partnerships with higher ed, the trade unions, and be able to resource creating those pathways and building the kinds of relationships with community-based programs that Commissioner Moore talked about. This has been the biggest challenge. One of the greatest needs as people leave, and even in preparation for that, is the ability to have somebody kind of walk them through. Last year in the Public Safety Committee, Jeff Korzenek, who is an economist with a Third Fifth Bank, talked about the fact that this investing in this area with people who are returning to the community not only pays good dividends, but it's really critical for meeting the workforce needs of our entire region, as I said, out of Illinois. And so, we cannot leave potential good workers behind. And that's really what this investment does, elevates that. We've had a number of employers who have said, look, we need a certain training in this skill set. And it's been difficult to do that. The prison is a great place to be able to build those types of programs. The technical college or the community college build out that program, that training that may be needed, and then transition those people into those jobs as they return.
Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Chair Zhang. Thank you, Commissioner Schnell. I'm just wondering, and thank you for the great answer. How would organizations or businesses or somebody be able to connect with this program should they want to reach out and start to do some work with you.
Commissioner Schnell.
Chair, Representative Frankie, we do receive calls on a regular basis from employers looking to build that. We then have been connecting them with our education agency. We also have, there's a number of the nonprofits that agencies that Commissioner Moore talked about. BEAD is another great vehicle. I think the places where we've seen those types of contacts is for employers that may need a larger number of specifically trained types of individual. I'll just give one little example. We have a machine electronics program at Faribault. It's been operating at Faribault, run by Southwest State University in Minnesota here. And that program has a small cadre of people. But I can tell you that today that there are employers that are waiting at the door upon their release to be able to put those people to work. This is true of welding and our electronics program. All of them have been really critical.
Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, you know, kind of how you get the word out. Is so that it's basically more through nonprofits. Let's say there was a nonprofit or a business, could they just reach out to the DOC themselves?
Mr. Chair, if I could address
Commissioner Moore.
So there are some trusted vetted partnerships like with Emerge and the Mosque and Salem Inc., who have been doing this work both on the books and off the books for quite some time, that have the relationships not just with the guys who are in prison as they're coming home, but the services are often trying to pair and meet the overwhelming need of the DOC, that we've also have those relationships directly with employers who are saying, we are open to this. There's a team that goes out and looks for the employers, and the employers are also reaching out and saying, we need the help. We need the employees, because we do know that once a guy has been placed in and go through a vocational training, he's a part of a cohort of people that are going through some of the same, addressing some of the same barriers, they are much more likely to be successful. And so there are some trusted partnerships that, you know, that we're really doing the work and they're really being able to get a hold of the employers, and as well as have a great relationship with those who are coming home from prison. I know that one of the major things for guys who are returning home, or guys, women, is that there's an intimidation factor and also a language barrier. Oftentimes, what we see as lay information is not to them. How to fill out an application, how to do a apartment search, how to complete that gap in information where you wasn't in. And so these are the things that help to support their growth and their stability once they're home.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just respond to that a bit as well. I would just say, look, these resources are really about building and actively going out and building those pathways. But as I mentioned, Jeff Korzenek from the Third Fifth Bank, who talked to the House Public Safety Committee last year, he talked about the fact that some of these folks need that level of handholding and support. And that has kept some employers out of the sector. But we know that, and what he talked about was the fact that really having the kinds of resources and connections, supports, that nonprofits can provide, but we need to make sure that we are going out and aggressively building these strong partnerships, and especially in some areas of our state where they are particularly challenged around accessing workforce. And so we need to make sure we're out there. The need is great everywhere, but we have to be able to have the resources in order to build this to meet both our workforce needs as well as the needs of people who come.
Representative Frankie. Final question.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner and Mr. Moore. No, I'll just end with it would be nice. I mean, for a guy like me that's been searching for help for a long time and not being able to connect, who's willing and has been willing in the past to give people a chance, being one of them myself, that having that direct line of availability and somewhere to reach out to would just be helpful. So if you could give me that information, that would be great. Thank you.
Chair, no closing statement, and then we're going to go to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a practical, proven solution. This provides an opportunity for many individuals who have been left out, and I ask for your support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Norah Turner renews his motion that House File 4215 be referred back to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Norah?
Aye.
Chair Zhang?
Aye.
Lead Hamilton?
Aye.
Baker?
Baker, aye.
Dabney?
Dabney, aye.
Frankie?
Frankie, aye.
Greenman?
Aye.
Haley? Haley? Juergens?
Juergens, aye.
Cagle?
Aye.
Katiza Watun?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Zhang?
Aye.
Haley? Haley? Chair Zhang, there are 12 ayes and one excused.
12 ayes and one excused. Mr. Chair, your bill is on its way to the next committee. As noted earlier by Chair Norah, we are going to recess and reconvene later this evening. I believe staff will send information about the timing, approximately around 7 p.m., as Chair Norah and I spoke earlier. Chair Norah, I don't know if there's anything else you want to add on to that.
I just wanted to check in with Lead Hamilton. I know he unmuted.
Lead Hamilton?
So, Mr. Chairman, in the past, we've been able to run this committee a little bit later. I don't know if we can do that. How many bills do we have left?
I believe we've got four left. Yeah.
Four left. Okay.
And this is the final hearing.
Pardon me?
This is the final bills hearing that we have. So, and we cannot meet beyond this time right now because of the other committees that are going to be coming up. Wednesday is a little bit tough. So we have, everyone is in the final process of getting bills done this week.
Okay. And so, Mr. Chairman, I do have my testifiers on. What time do you think we'll be coming back, just so I can make sure that they're back as well?
I think to be more precise, 7 p.m. I don't know if Mr. Stumalanga has got any addition. 7 p.m. is what we're anticipating to get back.
Yep. Mr. Chair and Lead Hamilton, I will make sure to send out a notice for 7 p.m. 6:45 was the earliest we could reconvene, but 7 p.m. is a little bit easier, I think, for folks' schedule. So I will send that out this afternoon.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, appreciate. All right, I repeat again, I call this Committee on Workforce and Business Development back to order, and we'll start with the bill that was before us, and then we'll go to 4512. Mr. Chair, we'll go to 3807, which I am assuming is going to go very quick. Chair Zhang.
Sure. Chair Norah, would you like to motion your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 3807 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Go ahead, Mr. Chair.
With that, I wanted to introduce the bill. Mr. Chair and members, I think we are all aware of the most difficult situation that we see on our televisions with so many refugees across the world. The world is facing the biggest refugee crisis than ever before, where millions of people are forcibly displaced from their country by war or persecution. We have seen this repeat over and over again. But one thing that we should not forget, welcoming refugees is not only a humanitarian effort, but an investment that can yield substantial economic dividends. Refugees can contribute economically in many ways as workers, innovators, educators, entrepreneurs, taxpayers, consumers, and investors. I know many of you have not worked with some of the most incredible organizations who do this job day in, day out. Most of them are voluntary organizations that welcome refugees from the world every single day. From Ukraine to Afghanistan to other parts of the world. That's why we have to do that investment up front to support those new arrivals so that they can succeed when they arrive from day one. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to invite my testifier to testify on this House bill, and I ask for your support.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Next testifier is Jane Groblan. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed. You're muted.
Sorry. I'm Jane Grotman. I'm the Executive Director of the International Institute of Minnesota. Chair Noor and Co-Chair Shong and members of the committee, it's an honor to be here and I appreciate the opportunity to testify. So House File 3807 will help new Americans integrate into their communities more quickly by providing comprehensive employment services coupled with case management services, a formula that we know works. Services will be provided by the International Institute of Minnesota, the Minnesota Council of Churches, World Relief, and Catholic Charities in Rochester. This request will help clients reach not only their first job, which is a big step in a new country, but also advance into higher paying positions to help stabilize their families. New Americans need to go to work quickly once they arrive in Minnesota and to the United States, which often means that they stay in low-wage jobs without opportunities to or support to advance their wages and their careers. And we often are losing a lot of talent by that fact. We've also included some support for legal services because we know adjusting to citizenship status, a permanent status, families have access to more jobs, different jobs, better paying jobs, and research shows that they increase their rates of home ownership as well. Our community has welcomed more than 1,248 Afghan refugees within the last 5 months. And as Chair Noor referenced, we are anticipating even larger influx of Ukrainian refugees. So this bill, investing in this bill, will help them advance into higher paying jobs. We currently have three Afghan physicians who just arrived in the last couple of months working in very entry-level jobs. One is actually folding laundry in a location very far from his home. These services, these employment services and case management services, will help more new Americans move into jobs into healthcare where they can apply their skills and talents, and it will help others like them move or advance into higher paying jobs into other industries. So lastly, I just want to say that pretty amazing statistic. In 2017, 97% of the new workers in Minnesota's labor market were immigrants, were new Americans. 97% of the new workers in our state. And this is data published by the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. So new Americans are critical to the economic vitality of our state and of our future. So with that, I'd like to, if it's okay, to introduce my fellow presenter, testifier, Mohammed Zelmai. And I know he's been trying to get in the meeting. Are you there, Mohammed?
Mr. Zelmai, please identify yourself for the record and proceed if you are here.
Just see.
And I was looking forward to testify, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, he's been trying to get in the meeting. He said, I don't know, Nick, if you see him trying to get in.
I do not see him in the waiting room here. He might be on the old link. I made sure to send him the new link for the evening hearing.
Thank you. I had sent him the new link, so I don't know if he tried maybe the old link. If he doesn't get on in a minute, we'll see if he gets on here. I'll ask him.
Chair Noor, while we're waiting, did you want to make any remarks?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think you've had the testimony from one of our experts in the field of immigrants and refugees. As you and I know very well, Chair Zhang, it's always the jobs that we do which are considered to be dirty, difficult, dangerous, and dull jobs, meaning the 4Ds, and they yield dividends. And those are jobs that are really critical to also to our economy. I've been there as a new immigrant, you know, finding that first job, getting paid less than $7, you know, during that time. But you grow in your way up. Small investment will yield a big result. And that's what we're doing with this bill. And if we don't have Mr. Zalman, who's also part of that transition, I think we can give him another chance at a different day. And so welcome any discussion from the members.
Any questions from members?
I will note, Mr. Chair, that Ms. Grotman, if you do have written testimony, you are more than welcome to read that into the record.
Oh, thank you. So I will read on his behalf. I feel very bad. He was here this afternoon, and then this evening he had time from his job. So I'll read his testimony. Thank you. My name is Mohammed Zalmai. I am from Afghanistan, where I worked as an interpreter for the United States Army. I was evacuated from Afghanistan and arrived to the United States in October 2021. I spent 1 month at Fort Bliss in Texas before coming to Minnesota in November. When I arrived to Minnesota, the International Institute placed me in their employment program. They listened to my interests, my work experience, and helped me build a resume and taught me how to apply for jobs in the United States. After only 3 weeks in Minnesota, I got a job cleaning laundry for $16 an hour. They provided everything I needed to succeed in my job, including transportation to and from work every day and money for work clothes. A couple of months later, I was able to use my experience working in the United States to find a higher paying position at a different factory for $18 an hour. I'm also working as an interpreter at a local clinic. Having a job and making my own money has helped me to feel independent and start my new life in the United States. I want to encourage you to support the jobs bill to fund the International Institute's expansion of their employment programs. The programs provide quick job placements, U.S. work experience, and opportunities for career advancement and wraparound support for new Americans like me who wish to become financially independent in their new lives. Thank you so very much for hearing my testimony.
Any questions from members? Lead Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Chair Noor, or maybe to the testifiers, we have just remarkable people, refugees that have located out in greater Minnesota, whether it's Worthington or Marshall or, you know, some of the other communities. Can you just share with me how we're going to be able to provide services to individuals out in greater Minnesota as well? Maybe I missed that, but if you can just touch on that a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lead Hamilton. As I'm aware of, the VOLAGs are connected together, meaning the voluntary agencies that welcome refugees. And so I'll let Ms. Grotman to extend how she works with individuals across the state.
Yes, we will be including Rochester in this. They'll be one of the partners in this bill. So Catholic Charities in Rochester, who serves some of the areas that you mentioned, will be helping to provide those services in outstate, in southern Minnesota.
And Hamilton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I'd just like to stress, like I said, we have just wonderful, wonderful, beautiful people. I've taken the time to go out and meet with many of the families throughout southwestern Minnesota. And we just want to make sure that the services that we're providing, whether it's Rochester, St. Cloud, Minneapolis, St. Paul, that we also have those services available to refugees that are located out in, again, Worthington, Marshall, some of those areas, Wilmer area. So Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to comment on.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Groltman, for your testimony and Chair Noor for the bill. I'm curious, is there anything in base funding in our deed budget for these refugee job assistance programs?
Chair Noor.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair, thank you so much, Representative Haley, for asking that question. It's a very important question for us to look into. We don't have any base funding allocated in this bill, but it's really critical knowing that we're going to be seeing a lot of refugees coming not only to our state, you know, in different places within the state. One thing that I think I'm more worried about is the secondary migration, whereby individuals who arrive in one state, which we're very well known of, the state of Minnesota is the highest recipient of secondary migration, meaning that individuals who arrived in a different state, let's say, for example, in Texas, they could not find communities that they can connect to when they move to the state of Minnesota. Their funding from the federal government usually stays with the state that welcomed them. So technically, I think this is a dividend, small dividend that we're going to be starting. And hopefully during the discussion, we can find other ways to support newly arriving refugees and immigrants throughout the state. It's complicated, but I'm willing to do whatever it takes to support all those who are coming in.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Chair Noor. So just to be clear, and I appreciate that statistic on refugees coming into Minnesota from other states. So, but you said we do not, am I clear then, we don't have any base funding in our deed programs? And so I'm trying to understand if this is an addition to base funding or we don't have any base funding in our budget today. So you are saying we do not?
Chair Noor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Haley, we do not have any base funding for refugees and immigrants, although, as you have noted, the governor is planning to introduce the Office of New America, which will be based in deed so that they can support all those who are newly arriving and connecting them to different programs so that they're not left out as part of the bigger workforce program. So I intend to support that initiative. That will be a great starting point. But this is an immediate need right now that we can do a small investment that will yield a big dividend for all of us in the long run.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Chair. That's all.
Any more questions? Seeing none, Representative Chair Noor, would you like to make your closing statement?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think we all know that we are in a difficult situation, not from welcoming new refugees and all those things, but also in the workforce shortage. So this is a moment that we can invest resources to show that we're willing to welcome new refugees, but also give them the tools that they need to succeed in life. And I will ask for your support for this small investment that can yield a big result for all of us.
And I'd also like to renew your motion to lay over the bill, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion House File 3807 be laid over for possible inclusion.
All right, the gavel's back to you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Chair Zhong. So with that, as I promised, Lead Hamilton, you have a bill, and then we'll go to Representative Greenman after your bill. House File 4512.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move House File 4512 to be held for possible inclusion.
Very well. Please proceed, and I see you have an A1 amendment if you wanted to move.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. If I can move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I'd like to present it, and basically what the amendment does is it states that if a recipient of a scholarship fails to fulfill their requirements, the foundation may convert the scholarship to a loan, Mr. Chairman. So I ask for your support.
Very well. Hamilton moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Seeing none, the A1 amendment is adopted. To your bill as amended, Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just give a brief overview, and then I do have three testifiers, I believe, so I want to save time for them. Mr. Chairman, here a little while back, there was a group of mayors from southwestern Minnesota that identified an issue of students that were leaving our state, leaving our area. And then also we have a huge need for employees across the area as well. And so they came up with a proposal that would create a southwestern Minnesota pilot project to offer up scholarships for the students to attend the local Minnesota West colleges down there, take the courses, and then subsequently find employment in the area, Mr. Chairman. So at this time, I'd like to turn it over. I think Mr. Simonson or Mayor Cooley would want to go first to walk us through the bill and share your testimony, please.
Mr. Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm just going to make a few comments about some of the mechanics of the bill, and then we'll turn it over to the mayors. But my name is Eric Simonson, for the record. I work for Flaherty & Hood as a lobbyist, and today I'm representing the Southwest Council of Mayors. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hamilton, for carrying this bill. I know you've been very passionate about this issue, and it's really important to areas of Southwest Minnesota. Mr. Chair, this program is modeled, in addition to being kind of the brainchild of the Southwest Council of Mayors, it's modeled after a program in South Dakota known as the Build Dakota Program, which is essentially an educational opportunity in exchange for a work commitment from the student, and it's modeled after that. But it really recognizes that you know, parts of Minnesota don't just have a workforce problem, we also have a population problem. And that's one of the things that we're trying to accomplish in this bill is not only fill some gaps in our workforce, but grow our populations in areas of rural Minnesota. This bill is an outside-the-box effort to accomplish both of those needs. It is a pilot, as Representative Hamilton has indicated, for 18 counties in southwest Minnesota and the lower and upper Sioux Indian communities. That is the same footprint as the Southwest Initiative Foundation, and you'll hear from them a little bit later. The bill works fairly simply. We modeled it that way for a particular reason. But essentially, the funds that get appropriated by the legislature would go to DEED, and DEED would turn around and award a grant to Southwest Initiative Foundation. SWIFT would then award scholarships to eligible students and qualified programs. Those two terms are defined within the bill. Eligible students are encouraged to be either resident or non-residents. Keep in mind, we're trying to grow the population here. And those students must enroll in a program at least half time. SWIFT will control the scholarship and be in communication with the Minnesota West colleges throughout the extent of the educational period, as well as the subsequent work requirement. The Regional Workforce Development Board, who you'll also hear from a little later on, will annually develop a list of high demand programs and jobs for each Minnesota West campus. And the Initiative Foundation and those individual campuses will work to maximize the employer partnerships and create employer sponsorships for our students. SWIFT will manage the entire fiscal program and the effectiveness of the program, and they will report back to the legislature on an annual basis. And the items of that report is spelled out in the bill. And the key to this entire bill and program is that students shall commit to a three-year employment with an employer partner physically located in one of those counties. In exchange, employers that contribute to the scholarship program will receive a full tax credit on behalf of those scholarship contributions. So that's kind of the mechanics, Mr. Chair, of how the bill would work. I'll be here to answer any questions as they come up afterwards, but you have a great slate of testifiers ahead of us.
Thank you so much, Mayor Cooley. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name's Mike Cooley. I'm the mayor of Worthington, Minnesota. And I might add that we are probably the most diverse city in the state of Minnesota. And I might add, Mr. Chair, you can send as many of those refugees down to Worthington as you'd like. We have a lot of experience. Getting on to the bill, I want to give you greetings from the Southwest Minnesota Council of Mayors. We formed this group of mayors to work for economic development and other issues in our region. We are engaged, we are motivated, and we are united. All seven communities, Jackson, Worthington, Laverne, Pipestone, Marshall, Granite Falls, Canby. The issue of workforce retention and attraction quickly rose to the top in our initial discussions because we've had intense pressure from the state of South Dakota with their Build Dakota program. Iowa has a similar program, but they don't have the marketing up and running as much as South Dakota does. But if that happens, all bets are off. In talking, you know, from a mayor's standpoint in Worthington, literally our businesses are in a chokehold to grow or even to survive because of a lack of employees. There is a major truck repair firm in Worthington that has 8 service bays, and they struggle to keep 4 of the bays in use because of shortage of mechanics. One of the areas is diesel mechanics in this bill. So this is a major truck repair that's, they can only run less than 50% of their business. One business has spent over $80,000 in the last 2 years on employee attraction and retention and education. We have 3 ag science, ag bioscience vaccine companies internationally, Merck, Newport Labs, which is owned by a German conglomerate, and Cambridge. Lab technicians could be a big issue for us. But at the end of the day, many of the business owners told me it's about time. It's about time that we address this issue and be more aggressive because at the end of the day, if our employers don't have employees, the employers may just move. And that would be devastating for Southwest Minnesota. Our economic development, our local economic development authorities, our businesses, our communities, we're willing to invest along with the states in this 5-year pilot program to attract and retain a strong, educated workforce. So with that, you know, I would plead with the House to take a look seriously at this pilot program. And we know it's for Southwest Minnesota, but you know what? If we can get this right, maybe if other regions of the state want to invest, maybe it could be rolled out after we take care of the initial problems. But we want to be at the forefront. So, and with that, I want to end on a lighter note. You know the old saying, be aware of the mayors. So, and I would also like to extend Representative Ron Hamilton has been a great leader for Southwest Minnesota. Over the years, he's shown the willingness to reach across the aisle to fix problems that needed to be fixed and with great common sense. So with that, I thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and the committee. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mayor Cooley, for your testimony. And I think that noted that you are open to more refugees and immigrants coming to your state, to your city. And you'll start seeing that as we promote areas that are more welcoming and supporting the local economy. So thank you so much for your statement and for your support. And the next person on the list is Mr. Marquardt. Scott, please welcome to the committee, introduce yourself, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Scott Marquardt. I'm on staff, Senior Vice President at Southwest Initiative Foundation. We're the administrator or intermediary named in the bill, and grateful to be here with you tonight. We're honored and ready to be a part of this project. If this bill would continue to go forward, we fully support it and the incredible work that the Council of Mayors is doing. And we're also grateful to Representative Hamilton for his leadership and for sponsoring this, in addition to Senator Weber, companion bill in the Senate. Just a few administrative things. Eric and Mayor Cooley have already wonderfully laid out the need, and you'll hear from Carrie, too, about that. From our perspective as administrator, we are ready for this going forward. We have experience with scholarships and partnerships with DEED. Grateful to Commissioner Grove and the team at DEED for all the investments that have been made during the pandemic, you know, that have catalyzed out of your committee, Mr. Chair. And we're ready for this one, too, going forward, especially being a pilot. We're really pumped about that and what it might mean. Just a few things I'd like to lift up. This is a beautiful alignment with a lot of the work that's being done right now with career pathways and other workforce development efforts to ensure economic competitiveness as all of our businesses compete in a global marketplace. As Mayor Cooley mentioned, the competition with South Dakota is fierce. Our region borders two states, and our one, especially to the west, is working very hard to attract the talent, the investment, and the businesses across the state line, or to encourage bright people from Minnesota who have a dream for their main streets and their industrial parks to launch it to the west instead. We believe that this bill is part of the essential group of resources that the state is putting forth to counteract that competition, to ensure an equitable pandemic recovery that works for all Minnesota families. And something else I just really want to lift up that's, I think, huge about this bill is the opportunities for private engagement, the collaboration across sectors, starting with the investment from the state, but also how the private sector can engage our Minnesota West College system and the nonprofit organizations and workforce groups that will be involved. So we believe this is a beautiful collaboration. It's grounded in data. Won't get into the weeds in the interest of time, but we see on here that analytics will be used to ensure the money is going for the trades, the professions, and the people who need it most that can have the most impact for our communities. So, again, we are grateful for the opportunity to be named as the intermediary. And I can't say enough how important this is. The competition is fierce. The race for talent is fierce. But I have hope. The number of businesses on Worthington's Main Street and Jackson's Industrial Park in Marshall, all the way across our region. These entrepreneurs want to invest. They want to come alongside the capital and the passion that built our region and built our state. And the time is right for this. So we appreciate your trust, and we look forward to launching this along with our mayors. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Speaking of mayors, I see Mayor Myron Cortez. If you wanted to proceed with your testimony, and then we'll go to Ms. Bendix.
Thank you, Chairman Orr. I'm going to just highlight a couple things because I don't want to take a lot of time on items that have been mentioned already. Probably one of the first things that I want to talk about is when we were meeting as a council of mayors, we kept hearing about the outgoing migration of talent out of our area. And that's what kind of inspired us to really take a look at what at this program and started drafting up some ideas. And one of the things that we did determine on these occupations that out here in outstate Minnesota, there are opportunities to be employed and or to start entrepreneurship and compete on gross income equally as to what's up in the Twin Cities. So we have opportunities out here. It's not like we don't have opportunities. And then finally, I'm just going to talk a little bit about the pilot program. What I really like about it is that we're putting money out there, but we're going to have analytics to determine if that money is used properly and we're gaining on what our goals are. So many times, I being an elected official also, we'll kind of throw money at something, hoping that it'll take care of itself. this actually measures the outcomes. And then finally, with the workforce development boards being involved in it, we're going to be constantly looking at those critical occupations that need to have attention for the continued development of Southwest Minnesota. And with that, Chairman Noor, I will be quiet.
Well, thank you, Mayor, for your testimony. The next person is Carrie Bendix. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Good evening. I'm Carrie Bendix. I'm the executive director of the Southwest Minnesota Private Industry Council and the Regional Workforce Development Board. In November, Southwest Minnesota set a record, a state record, for the lowest unemployment rate at 1.7%. 1.7%. The state as a whole right now is at 2.7%. These numbers demonstrate that we are in an unprecedented labor shortage. There is an immediate and a significant need to not only attract workers to Minnesota, but to retain the current and future workforce. Employers in Minnesota not only face the labor shortage here in Minnesota, but they also compete with neighboring states who are actively and intentionally attracting Minnesota students and workers to out-of-state companies. This legislation proposal will give our Minnesota students the same opportunity for scholarships here in Minnesota as are being offered to them in our neighboring states. Statewide, of the graduating class of 2020, of those who enrolled in college, 18% of them statewide went to colleges out of state. In Southwest Minnesota, in our economic development area, 28% of them went to colleges out of state. That's 10 percentage points higher. The recruitment efforts in our neighboring states is working, and we need to counter it in order to just maintain our future pipeline of workers. It is imperative that the state, as a state, we invest in our future workforce, providing them with opportunities to gain skills they need to fulfill the occupations we have most in demand. There, many of them are technical degrees in the healthcare, like nursing, mechanics, as was mentioned by Mayor Cooley. We have a great manufacturing. There's manufacturing maintenance jobs. So there's a whole list of jobs that would really qualify for jobs in high demand. Included in that is a commercial driver's license. Truck drivers are one of the largest occupations in demand, not only in Southwest Minnesota, but across the state. And we currently have 22 high school students that will graduate in the spring that are part of the Minnesota River Valley Regional Education District, and they want to get their CDL. The cost of the training is $4,000 to $6,000, depending on how much behind-the-wheel training that they need, and it doesn't qualify for financial aid. Preparing for a CDL doesn't qualify. This scholarship fund will help students get their CDL. This legislation will help address that. As Mayor Cooley mentioned, we have some of the most diverse counties and cities in the state. These diverse communities are growing, and are often new immigrants or new Americans. And from the programs that we operate through our employment and training programs, we know that students often forego their education due to the demands that they have to help meet their needs with the family. And this scholarship fund will go a long ways in helping address both the employment and education disparities that we face in our state. So Southwest Minnesota is a significant part of the Minnesota economy. We're a national leader in agricultural production and renewable energy. We have a great manufacturing industry. As the Workforce Development Board's executive director, I urgently and respectfully request an investment in Southwest Minnesota's workforce development scholarships. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Bendix. Members, any discussion, or do we have anyone else here to testify? Discussions? I just have a couple of questions, Lead Hamilton. I know the process is to avoid being seen as a scholarship for college, because some of the programs may not be funded as a college program. What is the opportunity for this to be funded through the Office of Higher Education compared to the Department of Employment and Economic Development?
Mr. Chairman, I guess we're going through DEED because we're modeling it as a program for employees, you know, an employee-employer type program. I guess that's why we submitted it for a request through DEED. I don't know if Mr. Simonson has any additional comments on that.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Simonson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's a very good question. And Representative Hamilton is exactly right. That is the way the program is built. It's based on that South Dakota model with a Minnesota twist, of course. But we envision this as an economic development issue. And it's not to say that we couldn't go through OHE and go through the traditional process and create a more traditional scholarship program. But if you just look at the players that are around the table here with the Initiative Foundation and the Workforce Development Board, those are the folks that we want working on this. And those are the folks that we want to engage as partners. And that's frankly who DEED is used to working with. It made really good sense. I will tell you that we spent a lot of time in communications with the Minnesota West colleges trying to figure out the best path forward to put this together. And the folks that you see here with the foundation and the Workforce Development Board, this is the team I think that you want to pull this together. It makes the most sense. It's the cleanest. And they're all so used to working together. It just seems to make the best sense.
Mr. Simonson, just another question. DEED has got the partnership program, which is bringing employers and employees whereby you work with the higher education institutions. The grant is up to $400,000. This committee funded millions of dollars for that program, which is available through DEED, which is a partnership between the institutions of higher education, between employer and the workers, so that that program can exist. Has there been an approach to look into that program? Your model really fits into that, trying to make sure that we fund this program with not only through this legislative process, but existing programs.
No, that's a really good question too, Mr. Chair. And the short answer is yes, we've looked at that. I think what we would envision doing, and the reason why we created a pilot in a specific corner of the state, is that we could figure out going forward, how does this mesh with existing programs? What can we do going forward that makes the most sense based on, frankly, the root of this bill is the 3-year work requirement. How do we make that mesh with existing programs? And what do we need to do going forward to get the best bang for Minnesota's public dollar? So to answer your question, yes, we looked at it. I think this is going to be continued to looked at over the course of the next few years. As we report back to the legislature on an annual basis, these are the conversations that we need to have. We don't want to duplicate anything that's out there. And if there's a better funding source, then we should pursue that. And the last point I'll make about the funding source, the A1 amendment that the committee voted on here just a little bit ago, it changes the revenue source from the general fund to the Workforce Development Fund. That's not an ideal source for us, to be honest with you, because it does have a negative impact on the Workforce Development Boards across the state. But in trying to advance this bill forward and hopefully get it into conference working with the other body, that was our best choice. So I'll just be upfront with you about that. But that's not our first choice, but it's our best choice today.
Well, Mr. Simonson, I think speaking of the Southwest Minnesota Workforce Development Board, which I think we had in this committee trying to come up with a way to support this kind of a program by funding directly the Workforce Development Boards, which I believe if we are able to do that, this program may be funded through the Workforce Development Fund if we end up including Representative Krisha's bill, because it's more directly goes directly to the Southwest Minnesota Workforce Development Board, the 16 boards across the state, and we want them to become more, you know, innovative and creative. We're focused on the same things that we just talked about right now. So hopefully I'm trying to find a place where we can land safely without putting new restrictions and conditions, which may be seen as a higher education requirement. But those options are available, and I look forward to working with Lead Hamilton to make sure that we find those options for the Southwest. I see, before I go to Haley, I'll go back to Ms. Bendix.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I just wanted to add, I think one of the significant differences between the scholarship funds that you had mentioned before that went through the colleges is generally you have to enroll in a credit-bearing course. In CDL, for example, would not necessarily qualify for the scholarship. So this fund is much more flexible and responsive to the local needs. And it also really ties the individual who is getting the particular credential or degree to the employer. So it's not just education, it's employment. And it's employment in Southwest Minnesota with the commitment from the student. So it's very workforce-driven more than maybe education-driven, if that makes sense. And I think those are two really important distinctions in this pilot program from the previous scholarship program or the scholarship program. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks, Lead Hamilton, for the bill and the mayors and all the representatives from your community. Lots of good discussion tonight on this idea. And I know we've got more bills, you know, to discuss tonight, but I just wanted to add in, I had a bill last session as well for a requirement that students that we give state grant dollars to, that we require them, you know, to stay and work in Minnesota, because I do believe that's an essential part of solving this workforce shortage, and it's smart fiscal policy on our behalf. So I really appreciate the creativity that Representative Hamilton has had in working with his community, and they've done such a good job of bringing all these partners together to be creative, and they're facing competition from literally right across their border. You know, it's 30 minutes away that those graduates from our high schools and our two-year and four-year colleges are going to work across the border. So we have to be creative and innovative, and we have to take some risk to address this issue. So I just want to say I appreciate the work and the effort, and I think this idea has a lot of merit, and we need to, you know, try some of these approaches to keep our students and our workers here in this state and help us address our shortages. Thank you, Lead Hamilton, and thank you, Chair Noor.
Thank you, Representative Haley. I think this is a good bill that we need to be looking for better ways to make sure the resources are available for those competitive areas in our state. So with that, Lead Hamilton, your closing remarks.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the thanks goes to the mayors. I mean, they're the ones that were working on this, and then they reached out to the other testifiers that are on here as well. And so then once they did all the work, they reached out to myself and Senator Weber, and we introduced the bills. But again, all the credit goes back to the mayors and, you know, the tremendous work that went into this. So I also would like to thank everybody for the very thoughtful discussion around all this. And Mr. Chairman, hopefully we can find a funding source to bring this to fruition. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you so much, Lead Hamilton. Lead Hamilton renews his motion, House File 4512, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you so much. Thank you to all the testifiers. We go back to House File 3475. Representative Greenman, to your bill. Please move the bill and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 3475 be laid over for possible inclusion of the omnibus bill.
And I see you've got a DE1, if you wanted to move the DE1.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the DE1, and I can just quickly explain it. It's an amendment that moves the appropriation from MEDA to the Community Reinvestment fund and increases the appropriation to $2 million. The amendment reflects conversations between MEDA and the CRF that made sense, made more sense for the Community Reinvestment Fund to be the fiscal sponsor for the Inclusive Growth Fund.
Please, to the members, I think the amendment is a straightforward amendment. Any discussion? See none. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? See none. DE1 is now adopted. To your bill as amended, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will keep this brief because I know we have some testifiers, I think, that are still here from this morning or this afternoon. I'm grateful to be here to be able to present House File 3475, a bill that appropriates $2 million to the Community Reinvestment Fund to make grants and loans to support the Inclusive Growth Fund's work to equip communities-based lenders with the liquidity and capital support they need to meet the unique recovery and building needs of the communities they serve. The Inclusive Growth Fund reflects a collaboration between five of the leading Minnesota-based minority business organizations. It's currently a $17 million fund that reflects a combination of senior debt from banks, patron capital foundations, and grants from supporting organizations. The model is unique in that it provides liquidity to businesses in need of technical assistance and expertise, to support the small businesses and their growth. The loans to the Inclusive Growth Fund help affected small businesses recover from the pandemic. They're focused on providing capital support for women-owned, veteran-owned, minority-owned businesses. This funding will go to increasing the Inclusive Growth Fund's ability to ensure that they can have a statewide reach, and the grant must be matched with at least equal amounts of non-state funds. With that, Mr. Chair, I think we have a few testifiers to the bill.
Yes, Mr. Winston, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. So I'd like to thank Chair Noir, the committee, and Representative Greenman for having us here today. My name is Hollis Winston. I consult, project manage, and advocate on behalf of the Catalyst Coalition, which is a coalition of five organizations that exist to help primarily Black, immigrant, and people of color businesses grow. We provide technical assistance, consulting, and funding to those businesses, as well as advocate on their behalf. Our members' clients exist not only within the metro area, but increasingly throughout greater Minnesota and the state. So the pandemic had an extremely harsh and detrimental effect on many small businesses, very much small businesses of color as well. And coupled with an inability to access capital during this time, quite a few businesses are still struggling to recover from the pandemic. As a small business owner myself, I'm familiar with that struggle. And the concept of the Minnesota Inclusive Growth Fund was born out of the need to provide low-interest capital to not just minority-owned businesses, but to women and veteran-owned businesses statewide that are struggling or struggle to recover from the COVID pandemic. Coupled with the over 125 years combined experience of our members and thousands of clients served in 2021 alone, the fund model also provides wraparound support to ensure that the $2 million funding request we are asking for in this bill is used effectively and efficiently to save and strengthen the businesses that are so critical to their community's health, as well as the health of the state. The $2 million will be matched several times over by senior loans from banks, patient capital from foundations, and grant-making institutions. To date, we have raised $17 million in fund, but are looking to scale further to $50 million to meet community need. This funding request is a one-time ask. And again, we appreciate the opportunity to present in this committee. In attendance are some Catalyst partners. So we have the Community Reinvestment Fund, the Latino Economic Development Center, and we may have MEDA, but the client that's being represented by MEDA is actually at his business, so he's going back and forth trying to track. So hopefully they can pop in and say a few words. But I think next we have Community Reinvestment Fund with Frank Altman. And again, I want to thank Chair, Committee, and Representative Greenman for giving us the time to talk to the committee.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hollis Winston. I think the next testifier is Mr. Altman. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Frank Altman. I am a CEO and founder of Community Reinvestment Fund, a national nonprofit community development financial institution operating in all 50 states, but operating intensively in Minnesota, where we've made nearly $200 million in loans in communities throughout the state, including many of the communities that were represented by the last presenters. Our role in the Catalyst Coalition and the Minnesota Inclusive Growth Fund is really to be the administrator of the fund, the fiscal sponsor, if you will. We have raised collectively grants that come to CRF and then go into the fund, and the fund is now has been launched and is operational. It already has, in about a week, $2 million plus in applications that are pending and being referred to the different CDFIs that are part of the Catalyst Coalition. So this is a way of helping to reach the harder-to-reach borrowers that are served very elegantly and very effectively by our Catalyst partners that have cultural competence and the ability to have trust in communities that might not come to a bank or even directly to a bigger community development organization. So it's a synergistic relationship. We expect that the community impact over the next year to two will be significant, and it will leverage the private sector extensively with limited public dollars as part of the capital mix. So with that, I think I will describe the fund just a little bit, and then have to apologize that my colleague, Anisha, was supposed to be here, but unfortunately she had a conflict and could not join us this evening. She is really operating the fund within CRF. The fund, as you heard, is 17, right now is at $17.5 million, going to $50 million. It has broad support from organizations that don't normally get involved with community development, ranging from Alina to the Target Corporation to the Bush Foundation and the Margaret Cargill Foundation, among others. So a broad array of organizations have already come together to get this fund launched, see the need, and now we're looking for a boost that we can get it up to the next level. The fund makes fixed interest rate loans at 5%, fixed interest rates to both small businesses that are needing help coming out of the pandemic, and also small businesses that have the ability to start growing again as they are getting back on their feet. The loans will be at $100,000 to $250,000 or less, and they will have a five-year term. 5% interest rate fixed, which is important, I think, as we look at the rising interest rate environment that we're going to be in over the next year or so, as many as seven interest rate increases are going to happen in the next year to year and a half. These loans will remain fixed. I think that's all I have to say on this right now. I'd be happy to take questions later, but I'll turn it over to our next speaker.
Thank you so much, Mr. Altman, for your testimony. The next person is Mr. Blanco. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Buenas noches, Mr. Chair, members of this committee. Thank you for the opportunity to address this committee. My name is Enrique Blanco, the Director of Operations of the Latino Economic Development Center, or more commonly known as LEDC, and we're members of the Catalyst Coalition. I'm here to testify in support of House File 3475. For nearly two decades, LEDC has been assisting, supporting, financing, and launching hundreds of successful Latino microentrepreneurs in the Twin Cities Metro and Greater Minnesota. Our core programs are offered in Spanish and serve approximately 600 Latino microentrepreneurs annually. Over the past 2 years, we've experienced unprecedented demand for our services due to the economic challenges brought on by the pandemic. LEDC anticipates high demand for our programs over the next year due to the economic conditions we are facing. Access to capital for BIPOC microentrepreneurs is challenging. The pandemic has exacerbated many of the pre-existing financial challenges of Latino-owned businesses. According to the 2022 Stanford Latino Entrepreneurship Initiative report, the primary challenge for Latino entrepreneurship is the lack of available financing, causing a high use of credit cards and other sources that leave business owners personally vulnerable. In Greater Minnesota, we help farmers and entrepreneurs both start and grow from a farm business to a small restaurant. Take, for example, our clients Esperanza and Stephanie Lopez, owners of Spurs and Bar and Grill located on 4th Street in Wilmar. Our clients could not be with us today because they're tending to their business as they are facing employee shortages. Our clients received a loan from LADC in May of 2021. In their case, they received a loan, not only a loan, but continuing technical assistance support by LADC staff, sparing them from vulnerabilities mentioned above. Today, Mr. Chair, we are coming to ask you to partner with us and through HF 3475, expand the impact we have with BIPOC small businesses. All of the Catalyst partners in this hearing, we are working tirelessly to raise funds to continue impacting Minnesota BIPOC small businesses. We support this bill because we bear witness to the impact Latino and BIPOC small entrepreneurs have had in our state. Each of the Catalyst partners see the impact on a daily basis. We need the state to appropriate funds to invest in nonprofit organizations like the Catalyst Coalition members that serve small BIPOC-owned businesses. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I urge you to support House File 3475 and help us help you support our small business community. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person is Patrick Parso. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure.
Mr. Winston, I think you noted that no one would be from the media. So do we have Mr. Carter?
So Mr. Carter was unable to make it. He is a media client, but he's actually owns a restaurant, Taste of Rondo, and so he has to work at that restaurant through worker shortages as well. So he's on it.
Oh, thank you so much, Mr. Winston. With that, members, any discussion? So I do understand the challenges. I think many of you have talked about the lack of access to capital. But then the key question now comes to play is, what is the interest rate for most of the Catalyst members when it comes to supporting the same BIPOC members compared to the prime rate that we see from the banks? Is it Mr. Altman? I know you noted it's 5% fixed, and I don't know, Blanco, if anybody can state what that number is.
Mr. Chair, I think the interest rates vary based on the products that different organizations are offering and based on their cost of funds. So the more that organizations are funded with grant proceeds, their cost of funds becomes much less, and they can offer lower interest rates. But generally, it depends on the product, the term of the loan, whether it's collateralized or unsecured, which, by the way, the Minnesota Inclusive Growth Fund loans will all be unsecured term loans. So that's not giving you a very precise answer, but I think it's it ranges. But generally, CDFIs are lending at rates and on terms that are lower than bank rates, and oftentimes taking on higher risk credits than banks are willing to lend to.
Thank you, Mr. Altman, because we're trying to see how we can provide access to the capital from even to 0%, which will be determined by some of the Catalyst members. We've got the Emerging Entrepreneur as a good example, which some of the product that they lend to, it seems a little bit higher because it's an addition to the bank, prime rate. And sometimes we tend to, avoid taking some risky businesses, because that's why we're here, to support businesses. You have seen there's been an uptick increase during the pandemic, almost 10% increase in people who wanted to become entrepreneur, and we want to be able to support that. So thank you so much. No further discussion from members. Representative Greenman, to your bill as amended, this closing remarks.
Yeah, thank you, and I will keep it short. I know the hour is getting late, but I just wanted to thank our testifiers and know that all season, all session, we have been hearing and talking about the need for small businesses to support small businesses, and I think particularly in places that have been hardest hit by the last couple of years. And so what this does is it really focuses that capital support on businesses owned by BIPOC folks, by veterans, and by women. And this is really about making sure that they can start and sort of reach to that statewide demand. So I'd ask for your support. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will move that House File 3475 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you so much, Representative Greenman, and to the testifiers. And we will try to do our best to find better ways to support our small business. So thank you so much, particularly the BIPOC business owners. So the last bill for tonight is House 54707. Representative Cagle, welcome to your committee. Please move the bill and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 4707 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. And so House File 4707 is a $600,000 appropriation to MNSBIR Incorporated. And what that long acronym, what they do is they help fund startups and small businesses. They help them transform their high-risk, high-impact technologies to marketable products and services that solve problems. Last year, as you recall, I had the Launch Minnesota program, and so this is kind of the first step in that process. And so I will turn it over to my testifiers because I'm not doing a very good job of explaining this at 8 o'clock at night. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. I see Pat Dillon. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for having us today. I also want to take this opportunity to thank Representative Cagle for introducing this important legislation. So I want you to imagine you were a scientist or an engineer or a clinician, and you had a really novel idea that you know requires millions of dollars of R&D investments and years to complete. And there's no guarantees that it would work. Where would you seek this funding? This is at the heart of what I do on a daily basis. My name is Pat Dillon, and I'm the executive director of MNSBIR, Inc. Our mission is to help innovators, whether it's in a startup or a small business, to access research funding through a very special program that is $4 billion in funding each fiscal year. This federal funding supports research and development and commercialization of novel technologies that result in a new product or service that will generate revenues and jobs in the future. Since these programs were established by Congress in 1982 and 1992, respectively, Minnesota innovators have won $888 million. This has led to numerous social and economic impacts to include high-paying jobs, patents, investments, new products and services, research collaborations, IPOs, and mergers and acquisitions, and much more. In my humble opinion, these programs support the American dream. I often say that I witness the American dream in action every day. I've been working with innovators for 30 years, and throughout those years, I have helped small businesses to win more than $150 million that has led to jobs, products, and economic impact. I am bullish about the SBIR and SCTR programs. Since 2014, we have facilitated 50 innovators to win $50 million. Our portfolio includes innovators in the private sector, including startups from the University of Minnesota and Mayo Clinic. Our portfolio of innovators are bachelor's, master's, and PhD graduates from Minnesota educational institutions. These innovators are rooted in science, technology, engineering, and manufacturing that are connected to our key industries, sectors, medical, defense, biotech, electronics, et cetera. Our work is at the intersection of government, industry, academia, and federal laboratories. Our work supports angel and venture capital investments in startups. Our work also supports awardees that has a spillover effect through subawards and subcontracts with the University of Minnesota, the Mayo Clinic, and private sector services, suppliers, and manufacturers. Our work supports STEM internships through the SciTech Internship Program, a state-funded program. Our work is statewide. We have assisted innovators from all over the state to include Rochester, Duluth, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Winona, North Mankato, and Worthington. Our work supports BIPOC, women, rural, or veteran innovators. We are the SBIR Sherpa to help innovators navigate through the complex and overwhelming federal R&D environment through our education and mentoring. Navigating the R&D arena is no cakewalk. We understand the immense funding opportunities available from the 11 participating agencies to include the Department of Defense, the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, among others. We operate within the Minnesota Innovation and Commercialization ecosystem. We are a liaison between Minnesota innovators and the federal agencies with the money. We are recognized by the U.S. Small Business Administration, the University of Minnesota Technology Commercialization Office, the Mayo Clinic Office of Entrepreneurship, and hundreds of startups and small businesses as the go-to SBIR, SCTR expert resource. We are passionate about bringing federal dollars back to Minnesota to support our economy. And lastly, as a retired United States Navy commander with 40 years of service, active in reserve, and a combat veteran, I want to put Minnesota products and services in the hands of our men and women in uniform. This one-time appropriation of $600,000 could lead to $10 million in federally funded projects for FY23. This investment will mean an investment in Minnesota innovators to bring their novel and disruptive ideas to life. It will lead to job growth and retention. The state's investment will enable us to help Minnesota innovators be competitive at the national level. As you may know, Minnesota has not received its fair share of federal funding. We are lagging behind Minnesota, Michigan, Illinois, and even Alabama. Your investment to MNSBIR Inc. is vital and critical to keep Minnesota innovators and small businesses competitive to access these funds. I want to turn this over now to three small business owners that can share their stories about working with us. I thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you so much. Please call the first person.
Yes, I'd like to call Rob Wadlick, please.
Mr. Wadlick, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rob Wadlick. I'm a founder and CEO of Adapt Design Works. It's a really small business. I'm currently in the process of writing a phase one small business grant with the University of Minnesota. And I'll get into that in a minute. This bill really is about giving anyone with a good idea that's going to change people's lives or the way that we do business or industry, the opportunity to kind of take a step in the unknown and develop that idea where there may not have been funding or the opportunity to do so. And I mean anyone. I'm an undergrad with an engineering degree. I'm a quadriplegic. I speak from personal experience. About 6 years ago, a few years after my injury, I started a career with a medical device company as a project manager and community consultant. And that company was working to develop an exoskeleton prosthesis for people with upper extremity impairments, such as myself. We worked with Pat Dillon back then in Minnesota SBIR to obtain some early grant funding, which really helped drive the future of that company. And it really brought some innovative ideas out, which are incorporated in some of the design that's on the market now and helping people brush their teeth. I brushed my teeth for the first time for 8 years by myself with this device, feed themselves and so on. And it's on the market. It's FDA approved. It's currently creating jobs. And that's a direct result of, you know, helping these grants that Pat Dillon helps people get in her organization. So I'm currently in the process of developing a smart pressure seat that kind of helps prevent pressure sores, detects pressure, gallbladder issues for people with cognitive disabilities such as Alzheimer's, and so on, helps alleviate burden on caregivers. And so that's, we're hoping, we're submitting early next week. So hopefully we get that. So, and Pat's been instrumental in helping us identify funding sources and getting through all the hoops and things that are really, it's not a straightforward system, as you can imagine, with the federal government. So, you know, I want to say that, you know, this organization really helps drive, it's going to help drive the next generation of innovative products. One of the, I don't know if you know of the automated CPR machine that's in a lot of ambulances and hospitals now, that was developed from an SBIR grant. So that potentially, and they're based out of Eden Prairie or somewhere here in Minnesota, that wouldn't have happened probably if they hadn't had that initial jumpstart of funding and opportunity. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you so much for your testimony and your innovation and your contribution to the state of Minnesota. The next person is Dr. Mooneyham. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Ashley Mooneyham. I graduated with a PhD from the University of Minnesota in 2019. Then I secured a job as president of a medical writing and research support company. And in 2021, I became a new mom. So after attempting to use a breast pump to provide breast milk to my exclusively breastfed baby when I went back to work, I realized that the experience could be vastly improved. Therefore, I founded my small business, Mommy Solutions, in late 2021 to develop a new breast pump accessory that will help mothers achieve greater milk yield and less time at the pump. I took on a chief technology officer in early 2022 to begin prototyping, and we are currently applying for state and federal grants to research and develop the product. I connected with Pat Dillon in late 2021 to share my idea with her, and she encouraged me to apply for MNSBIR. After acceptance, MNSBIR connected me with many experts in the infant nutrition and wearable technology fields that really helped me build an important network of resources. For example, she connected me with other business owners that have had success in similar but non-competing line of products. She connected me with the co-director of the Wearable Technology Lab at the University of Minnesota. She recommended the Minnesota engineering firm that I intend to contract with should I win a grant award. And she also introduced me to a Minnesota-based successful SBIR applicant who applied to the same Target Institute as me for application guidance. All introductions have really contributed to the success of my business trajectory so far, and they've allowed me to build up a network of relevant contacts very quickly. Honestly, I would say her network is unmatched, and she generously makes introductions to benefit all MNSBIR participants, Minnesota business owners, and Minnesota Institutes of Higher Education. Since starting my company, I've applied for one Launch Minnesota Innovation Grant and two federal SBIR grants through the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation. Pat also provided valuable feedback on my application content and guided the organization and level of detail from an experienced grant reviewer's perspective.
I'm currently waiting to hear back on results, but I do know that my application was stronger thanks to MNSBIR and PAT's help. I intend to continue engaging with PAT should any resubmission efforts take place. Hopefully I win right away. Or should I move on from phase one to phase two grant applications in the future? For those that are less familiar, I know Pat gave a nice overview up front, but the SBIR program is a huge opportunity for small businesses to get non-dilutive seed funding for very high-risk, high-impact ideas. Phase one grants are frequently on the order of $300,000 to $400,000, and phase two grants can be up to $3 million in non-dilutive funding. Minnesota is a growing center for innovative small businesses, but still we are only securing a small proportion of total SBIR funding nationwide. In fact, right now we're ranked number 18 in overall aggregate funding, and I really think we can do much better. The MNSBIR program is an important investment to support Minnesota small business applicants in submitting competitive applications, so our SBIR funding can reflect the caliber of scientific innovation residing in Minnesota. Thank you so much for your time, and I hope you support this bill to help Minnesota small businesses.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for your contribution to the state and the research that you're doing. The last but not the least is Dr. David Kalmus. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is David Kalmus. I'm a physician with subspecialty training in interventional neuroradiology. 5 years ago, I co-founded with my colleague Waleed Brindikji, Marblehead Medical, for development and commercialization of devices used to treat patients suffering from life-threatening stroke. We achieved FDA clearance for two stroke devices, which led to Marblehead Medical being acquired by a major medical device manufacturer approximately 1 year ago. Marblehead Medical was focused on obtaining non-dilutive funding throughout its existence. Toward that end, we connected with Pat Dillon on numerous occasions throughout our journey. She provided key insights on how to apply for these grants, how to respond to reviews from the NIH, how to transition from phase one to phase two awards. She gave us confidence in our approach and essential insights into the process. She was especially helpful in navigating the nuanced budgetary processes. Between 2018 and 2021, Marblehead Medical was awarded a total of three NIH SBIR STTR grants, totaling more than $3 million. I am certain that the success of Marblehead Medical was achieved in large part from the financial support from the NIH SBIR STTR program. Success from the Marblehead Medical experience led us to co-found a second device company for which we have already been awarded another phase one STTR from NIH. Non-dilutive funding represents a key opportunity for Minnesota-based innovators. Such funding was key to our success, and I have met with numerous entrepreneurs in Minnesota who would similarly benefit from the MNSBIR program. I tell all of them to connect early and often with Pat Dillon and her program to ensure their own success. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kalmus, for your testimony and also for the innovations that you're doing. Members, this is a very intensive discussion when it comes to us to talking about investment in technology, which we did in terms of the Launch Minnesota. We also have the Angel Tax Credit and the Minnesota Business Innovation Research, which is the SBIR, which is something that we need to be leveraging, and also the Small Business Technology Transfer, SDTR, programs. There's phase one and phase two. These are really great opportunities, and maybe we'll have one day just going through some of those programs and how they really function so we can have a deep understanding. And I appreciate the testifiers for helping us understand the critical need for us to look into that direction for research and development that is needed for potential commercialization. So thank you. Two members, any discussion? Seeing none, thank you so much to the testifiers again. Representative Cagle, for your closing remarks and renewing your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill all came up really quick, so I really want to thank the hard work of both Pat and Candy on this. And, you know, to the testifiers, it seems like you kind of chose the testifiers perfectly for me in this bill, because there's probably products that Mr. Woodlick is working on that I'll be able to use soon. And the doctor previously with the breast pump machines was something I probably could have used in the past. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to present this bill today. And, you know, the thing about this bill is it's really making sure that we can expand MNSBIR's capacity. Right now, it seems like, you know, Ms. Dillon's a one-person show over there, and so we really need to make sure that we can get more people to help leverage some of this federal funding, because there's a lot of federal funding out there, and we need it to come to Minnesota. So just thank you very much, and thanks for hanging in there with me tonight, you guys.
Well, thank you so much. Representative Cagle renews her motion to lay House File 4707 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. With that, members, we're done with the hearing. And Lead Hamilton.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, has there been any discussion or decisions around budget targets, Chairman? Can you speak to that at all?
We're still looking into it, so we'll definitely come with some information soon. So I just wanted to connect with members, and I'll connect with you so we can talk about how we proceed. And I know we have so many good programs and good ideas that we need to be evaluating. So I appreciate you bringing up that conversation. This will be one of our last big hearing, but I'm not going to exclude any important bills that we need to really address. So stay tuned, and we'll connect. I know we have got more time left for next week to put something together before the end of before the break time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I see no further discussion, no agenda items. We are now adjourned. We'll come back next Monday in person again.